Tonight on The Download, the Metropolitan Planning Council's Marisa Novara, musician, artist, and filmmaker Adam Green, and another installment of The Worst with Amy Goose and Michael McCarthy. And now, here's your host, a man who is thankful for his two working thumbs, Justin Kaufman.
I could do so much with my working thumbs. I could plant, I could knit, I could play quarterback. Welcome to The Download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman with you till 11 o'clock tonight. Wow. Last night, a shocker of a Bears Monday night football game, one that we'd like to forget. You know what? I was thinking about a whole rant. I mean, obviously, we've been talking about the Bears through 24 hours now since that debacle opening game at Soldier Field. But you know what? This is a great city with so much culture, so much rich, some great people, the Chicago Cubs. We don't need to talk about the Bears. But before we put a moratorium on that, that was ridiculous. Was that not ridiculous? Someone just texted and they said, you know what? You know, everyone blames the quarterback. But you know what? This team has never had talent. And there's something to be said about that. There's something to be said about I wanted to say this to Roe, we're running out of time. The concept of they put that graphic up that showed like a bunch of faces. I don't know if we saw this because we were on the air. I just kind of saw it out of the corner of my eye. But Monday Night Football put up this graphic of all the Bears' faces, like just player cards, almost like a domino effect of cards. And it said, these are the Bears that were drafted from 2010 to 2016. And then they said, still on the team, and all the cards fell down, and only like two were standing.
Jeez.
Alshon Jeffrey and Kyle Long. The only ones that were drafted before 2014 that are still on the team. Let that sink in when you think about all the players around the league and you think about the fact that maybe there's something to be said about, yes, we've had Jay Cutler and there's been obvious problems, ups and downs. We've seen a level of quit in him that we don't see in other players. We also see a frail quarterback who continues to get injured season after season. But there's something to be said about the fact that there are only two players left from draft classes that were 7, 8, 9, 10 players deep. And, you know, there are teams not unlike the teams in our division, whether it be the Minnesota Vikings or the Green Bay Packers, that most of their roster are draft picks that they developed.
Mm-hmm.
So what does that mean?
Well, I think this, you know, it's a new regime here. They want to get rid of the old, start from the bottom.
Mm-hmm.
That way it gives himself, I got a perfect 7-year plan. We'll get to the Super Bowl in about 7 years.
And then call it out what it is. And then, yeah. I mean, obviously by looking at that stat, looking at that graphic they threw up, this is a rebuild. I mean, when you only have two draft picks that are from before 2000, I think it's 2013, 2014, it's a rebuild. It's all brand new players. But it was pretty telling to me. And it made me also believe with what the texter was saying that it's not just a quarterback. Although, I think if you had Pro Bowl caliber, you know, leadership at the quarterback level, a lot of the problems, the gray area, the thirds, the depth, the other things that are happening on the field could possibly be overcome. We've seen that in some situations where there have been really good quarterbacks on mediocre teams and they've been elevated. This is a situation where that just is not the style of our quarterback. This quarterback, Jay Cutler, almost needs to be involved with a Pro Bowl caliber team for him to be successful. And they said, you know, even looking back, the texter mentioned Lovie Smith saying, you know, they didn't make the playoffs through Lovie Smith. I'd make a little bit of a pushback in the sense that Brian Urlacher, Lance Briggs, Charles Tillman, Julius Peppers, you know, those were talented players that will be remembered in NFL history. Not necessarily even Devin Hester, you know, like they may not have been able to put it together with the chemistry on the field to make the playoffs, but it's a stretch to say that they didn't have the talent.
Yeah, talent. I mean, there's some Hall of Famers there.
Right.
You just didn't, you know, you had Rex Grossman. You just didn't, you couldn't, there's a few pieces that you couldn't put together to get that elusive Super Bowl.
Well, we'll continue to talk about the Bears tonight. Doug Plank's going to join us. We got a great show lined up tonight here on The Download with you till 11 o'clock, 312-981-7200. We're going to play The Worst later. Also got, like I said, Doug Plank coming through. Adam Green, great filmmaker, musician, artist, formerly at the Moldy Peaches. He's a tremendous folk, anti-folk musician. We're going to talk with him about his new movie, Adam Green's Aladdin, which is now available for streaming. So that's coming up as well in the 8 o'clock hour. News, weather, and traffic with Rob Martier and Roger Badish. Production provided by Pete Zimmerman. I'm Justin Kaufman, and this is The Download, a show about Chicago starring those who know it well. All right, we'll take a break. We'll come back. We'll do the carryout. Stay with us. All right, it's a download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. It's time for the carryout. This is, of course, our nightly segment where I read the news. So you at home, you don't have to. Here today's top story. Skittles are in the news thanks to a weird meme saying, if you knew three Skittles could kill you, would you take a handful? This comparison used to highlight terrorism and Syrian refugees. The candy company that makes Skittles responded to the meme that was tweeted out by Donald Trump Jr. by saying, Skittles are candies. Refugees are people. I don't know. Have you tried the sour Skittles? They do taste like people. I'm just saying. Donald Trump is in hot water because it seems that he paid personal legal bills upwards of $250,000 from his Trump Foundation. So he took charity money to pay for his personal debts. Didn't Jesse Jackson Jr. just go to jail for this? Oh, no, he went to jail because he bought Eddie Van Halen's guitar, not paid off personal debts. I see. Fine line. Fine line between stupid and clever. Former President George H.W. Bush is reportedly voting for Hillary Clinton. The former Republican president is no fan of Trump, seeing that his son Jeb ran and lost to the nominee. When reached for comment, Hillary Clinton was like, yeah, you know what, let's just go ahead and downplay that. Thanks, but no thanks. Yeah, we're good here. Nothing to see. Move along. Journalists are getting in hot water for participating in campaign media. Trib's John Cass apologized for being part of the Madigan quote-unquote documentary that's being released by anti-Mike Madigan forces supported by Governor Bruce Rauner. And now Sean Hannity's in trouble with Fox News for appearing in an ad for Donald Trump. Next, we're going to hear that Cass is writing about gold watches and Cialis. And Hannity, well, Hannity, he's just a walking Trump ad, so at least he's consistent. The Little League coach from Evergreen Park who took down the Jackie Robinson West team for fudging the boundaries is suing the league for emotional distress. Huh. If he wins, can we all borrow his lawyer? Because I'm still shaken from that controversy. Also, what about the emotional distress of the boys on that team? They get a life lesson in global humiliation, and this guy's having a hard time sleeping? Next, he's going to tell us that he spilled a hot cup of coffee into his lap. Ouch. The cops busted an illegal casino in Lincoln Park where 100 men were playing at 15 different tables in an empty storefront. Okay. What were the games? Blackjacks, craps, roulette, pie-gow poker? Please tell me they were playing pie-gow poker. I don't even know how to play. I want to know how to play. Their biggest mistake? Not having a high-priced show attached. That's how you run a casino. They should have given Band Styx a lounge show. Then everyone would just turn a blind eye. Corey Feldman went on the Today Show, put on a freakish performance that the internet made fun of, and now he's crying on Facebook because of all of the hate. I agree, it's ridiculous that Twitter is so mean. I also agree that it's ridiculous that Corey Feldman was on the Today Show. Can we move on? Isn't there more important entertainment news to cover? Can Corey Feldman just please be put to bed? 15 minutes of fame is over? What do we got here? It's breaking news. It was announced today that Angelina Jolie and Brad Pitt are divorcing. You know, who cares? Back to Corey Feldman. Anything but Brad and Angela, please. In weather, it seems to be getting hotter, not colder. I have a feeling I'm going to wake up one day and it's just going to be winter. As Morrissey said, fall is dead. I don't know if Morrissey ever said that, but he does hate meat. Missed that story entirely. In sports, the USA Today called the Bears a five-alarm dumpster fire after last night's humiliating loss at home to the Eagles. And if that performance wasn't embarrassing enough, the Bears announced today that quarterback Jay Cutler is day-to-day with a thumb injury, but some insiders say he's going to miss significant time. Linebacker Danny Trevathan will have thumb surgery, and his return is unspecified. Lamar Houston injured his knee. He's out for the year. Defensive tackle Eddie Goldman's going to miss 4 weeks with an ankle. Corner Bryce Callahan has a concussion, and Kadeem Carey pulled a hammy. Other than that, I'd say the Bears are relatively healthy, though. A terrible showing for the Bears, who lost their sixth straight game at Soldier Field, the longest streak since 1997. Do I have to remind you that Dave Wanstead was the coach in 1997? Or was it Dick Geron? Does it matter if his Geronner wants that? It doesn't matter. Either way, it's bad. It's bad. And really, I want to do a winner-loser breakdown, but who would you even give it to? Winner? Fans that left early. Losers? Me. For believing in this squad. All we ask from our football team in Chicago is that we're not the laughing stock of the league. And I guess that's just too much. That's it for the Bears. Their time's up. Make them wait for a table, Chicago. If any of those offensive linemen show up at the Outback Steakhouse on Tui, make them wait. Hour and a half wait. That'll teach them. All right, let's turn to baseball. The Cubs won last night. The Nationals lost, so the magic number to clinch the number one seed is 5. Ham Jam pitched well last night. He got the much-needed win. It's a September slop time. But it's important because baseball players are all about who's hot at the end of the year. See the San Francisco Giants. They're not a good baseball squad on paper, but it's all about the chemistry, teamwork, the good grades. Ah! Ah, I don't even know what I'm saying. I'm still so livid about the Bears. Sox slugger Jose Abreu told reporters that the Royals seemed to want to win more than the Sox after the Sox got beat up by the Royals over the weekend. Good observation from the Cuban slugger when asked about this, manager Robin Ventura sighed and went back to napping. The World Hockey Tournament is USA versus Canada tonight, and I, for one, hope that none of the Hawks play. They should be soaking up the final week of sunshine on a yacht off the coast of Belize right now, not playing in a useless tournament. Hawks camp starts this weekend. And finally tonight, a Chicago mattress store created a red welcome mat that sported the name Kaepernick and the number 7. They're encouraging customers to wipe their feet on it. You know, there's a former Packer safety, Darren Sharper, that drugged and raped over 20 women, right? I mean, allegedly going from city to city, drugging random women he met in bars. He's serving jail time as we speak. And he was a Packer. So you know what? There are much better choices than a quarterback that kneels. Rapist? Kneeler. That's the carryout for September 20th, 2016. Hey, we got a special on salt packets tonight. For every meal you purchase, we'll throw in some salt packets for free. I may go in a new business, Darren Sharper. Welcome, Mats. What do you think? Green and yellow should sell it, right? Right away. This is very right. All right, coming up, we'll talk about the hidden costs of segregation here on The Download. Stay with us, 720 WGN. All right, Rob Martier, how are you, my man?
I am so happy today that I'm a Steelers fan. I've got to tell you.
It's embarrassing.
You know what? I actually started feeling bad. I mean, there's a lot of anxiety out there, and rightfully so. The Bears just don't look good.
Yeah, it's just sad to have a Monday Night Football game, to have such a storied franchise, one that was at the beginning of the NFL, and to be on there and act like it's, you know, like it's Jacksonville in the 2000s.
Well, let's put it to you this way. Okay, so over the weekend you had the Patriots. I think they beat Miami, right?
Right.
Now, Miami still has a little way to go, but at least they were competitive. They came back in that game. Right. They made it a game. We didn't even get that from the Bears.
It's just so sad. You don't really know who the stars are. Alshon Jeffrey, I guess. There was a great article about the Bears offensive coordinator. Essentially, the offensive plan is to lob the ball to Alshon Jeffrey. Mm-hmm. And when teams adjust, and that's what's happened both weeks, when Jeffrey caught a ball early in the game, they adjusted, even doubled him or didn't give him that route anymore.
Yeah.
The Bears offense just looks like it's running around with his head cut off. Well, that can't be good.
In the immortal words of Dan Hampton, he used to be all Sean, then he was some Sean, and now he's no Sean. So, there you have it.
Thanks, Rob. Welcome back to The Download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman with you till 11 o'clock tonight. Coming up at 10 o'clock, we will have The Worst. This is where we complain about the worst things in our society for prizes. And we've got good prizes. We've got, a pair of tickets to an unforgettable evening of music with the Broadway composer Stephen Schwartz. Oh, so if you're a fan of Tony Award-winning musicals like Pippin, Godspell, and Wicked, you can hang out with Stephen Schwartz. Also, gift certificate of Lou Malnati's. We got a lot of stuff to give away tonight. 312-981-7200. That's coming up at 10 o'clock. Also, 9 o'clock, Doug Plank will join us to talk about that monstrosity of a game yesterday, if that's what you call it, the Chicago Bears. Also, Adam Green's going to join us. So we got a lot of great stuff tonight. So we'll get to all of that coming up here on the download. But right now, it's time for our How to Improve segment. This is our monthly check-in with the Metropolitan Planning Council. Talk about some of the issues facing us here in the Midwest, whether it's transportation, government efficiency, taxes, infrastructure. We have to put our minds together to come up with a plan for the short and the long term. So why not start right here on the download? That's the plan. That's what we've been doing with the Metropolitan Planning Council. And we continue tonight. We take on an issue that's way more complicated than infrastructure. But it's that the city of Chicago is definitely in need of improvement. That area is segregation. It's no secret that Chicago continues to be one of the most segregated cities in America. But what if it became clear that said segregation, keeping white and black populations apart, was costing money? Yep, what are the hidden costs to our society as taxpayers to the current setup? And would putting forth a plan for integration, would it increase efficiency? There's a conversation to have, and we're going to have it tonight. In studio with me, Marisa Navarro. She's a director at the Metropolitan Planning Council. Good to meet you. Thanks for being here.
Thanks, Justin.
So let's talk about that. I'm fascinated. First of all, this is a two-year study you guys are embarking on. This is brand new. So talk about why the Metropolitan Planning Council has identified this as an area to study.
Sure. So over a year ago, my organization, Metropolitan Planning Council and Urban Institute, set out to try to answer a question, which is really, you know, is Chicago's segregated status quo cost neutral? And really, this came up for me in a series of meetings about some changes to affordable housing policy where, and lots of changes that I was suggesting were sort of met with, oh, that'll cost too much money.
Right.
And it slowly began to dawn on me, you know, I think we have this sort of underlying assumption that our status quo is cost neutral. And so anything we want to change will be cost prohibitive. And it then occurred to me, well, we don't really have a way to counter that. We don't have a good argument or a good set of data to really get at, well, is that really true of our status quo?
That's so interesting. It's true. Like status quo will, especially even if the status quo is expensive.
Right.
Changing it in any way is a way that people just don't want to get involved in.
That's right. And so, you know, we were really interested in saying, well, so if there is a cost, then what is the impact to everyone? Because I think to the degree we do talk about segregation, it tends to be focused on what are the negatives that accrue to low-income people of color, people living in concentrated mm-hmm. poverty. And we really leave out the negatives that may accrue to people living on the other end of the spectrum in concentrated wealth, which is the other end side of that coin, right?
Right,
and
right.
Then, of course, also the dwindling number of people in between those two poles. So that was the impetus question. And then the second question, of course, is, well, if there is a cost, what do we do about it? What are the things we need to be doing? So we're kind of working in tandem on those two questions.
Okay. So, as we think about how to improve segregation, obviously the if you think about what's the opposite of segregation, it's integration. Obviously, the idea of taking neighborhoods or taking different regions of our city and being able to blend. But talk about that, because there's something to be said about Chicago being a city of neighborhoods, and ethnic enclaves are obviously a part of the city of neighborhoods. I would think that there would be some pushback to wanting to preserve the concept of, you know, historic black neighborhoods or historic German neighborhoods or what have you.
Sure.
As opposed to just, you know, making sure or some sort of social project where we all come together.
Sure. And that is an argument I've definitely heard a lot. And I would agree that ethnic enclaves can definitely be incredible places. And they've helped lots and lots of new Americans acclimate to life here and set up a whole economic structure and preserve culture and so on. But they're also not what I'm talking about when I'm talking about segregation. And that's for two reasons. Ethnic enclave experience is one that's very highly race dependent. And I think that's really important to remember. A couple years ago, there was a study out of Harvard that looked at Chicago neighborhoods and found that if a neighborhood is more than 40% African-American, it does not gentrify. The experience of African-Americans in middle-class neighborhoods is one that I've looked at. We looked at it at MPC and found that, you know, if you are living, if you're living in a middle-class neighborhood and you're African-American,
right,
the neighborhoods that surround you tend to be low income. If you are living in a middle class neighborhood and you're white, the neighborhoods that surround you tend to be affluent, more affluent than
wow,
you are.
Interesting.
So the experience of living in this city and across this region is highly race dependent. And I think that's a very important thing to keep in mind when we talk about ethnic enclaves, because that experience varies so widely by race. It's not the same thing to compare an ethnic
right,
enclave
right.
you to an area that, formed by state-sponsored segregation.
Right, right. You can't say that an area like Englewood is the same as Lincoln Square in the way that Lincoln Square is a German neighborhood, so Englewood is a black neighborhood. It doesn't work in terms of equality because they're not celebrating the same heritage, if that makes sense.
I think that's a fair way to put it.
Is that the way? I mean, the concept being that Englewood is going to find itself with so much more socioeconomic problems, where Lincoln Square is just saying, hey, this is great. The Germans settled here.
I mean, you know, the example I think of is my dad, who grew up in a Sicilian enclave in Detroit, right? And it was an incredibly, I mean, it was a very tight Sicilian neighborhood. There was no doubt that that was the feel and the vibe there, and it had a lot of positives. But they also had a fair amount of freedom, had they wanted to move across town to an area that was primarily Polish or German, among other white ethnics. They had a lot of freedom to mix had they wanted to. And that freedom is not afforded historically to African Americans in the same way.
There's so much. Let's take a quick break. But there's so much to talk about here. 312-981-7200 about the concept of whether or not segregation is cost neutral. And that's really what we're talking about here as the Metropolitan Planning Council studies this. They're embarking on a 2-year study to really get to the nuts and bolts of what is the cost of segregation in a city like Chicago. Marisa Navarra is a director at the Metropolitan Planning Council. She's my guest. We'll take a break. Stay with us. It's our How to Improve segment. We've been doing this every month here on the download on 720 WGN for the whole summer with the Metropolitan Planning Council. Tonight, Marisa Navarra is in studio. She's a director at the Metropolitan Planning Council. We're taking on the tough issue of segregation. And segregation, obviously, it's a negative word when it comes to the city of Chicago, because we've seen segregation, and you'll see that this is a segregated city, mostly because of the resource issue. And we've had this, you know, Natalie Moore was on the program talking about the book Southside, and we talked about the concept that their resources are not allocated similarly in the city of Chicago. So affluent neighborhoods, middle-class neighborhoods are getting more money than some of the other areas, and it almost continues the cycle continues in the city when it comes to segregation, poverty, all the things that are associated with it. And you guys are setting out to try and look at this issue over a 2-year period to see if you can determine where segregation lies when it comes to costing money. So let's talk about that, because one of the things that always gets thrown out about segregation is people want to live with people that they look like or that are the same as them. Mm-hmm. Is that true? I mean, because that's something that I feel I hear all the time when it comes to people who want to talk about segregation. Like, well, I want to live in a neighborhood with people like me. Is that true? I mean, you have stats on that.
Well, it's interesting because I think that assumes that everyone has an equal level of choice, right? In the places that they live. And what we increasingly know is that that's not the case. There's a study out of UIC here locally. Very interesting. They divided people, white, African-American, Latino, and asked for three things. One, what is the ideal racial makeup of a community that you might live in, a hypothetical community? And then two, what are the, when they actually did look at a place to move, what was the makeup of the place they actually looked in? And then three, what was the makeup of the neighborhood they ended up in when they actually moved? And profound differences across the three races that all three envisioned a pretty diverse neighborhood in the abstract, but in reality, white people looked in much, much whiter neighborhoods and settled in much whiter neighborhoods. People of color looked in much more diverse areas, but settled in areas that were much less diverse than was their ideal. And so the authors speculate, you know, very rational, it's likely that very rational sense of a sense of impediment that stopped people from feeling that they
could
do that.
But there was this feel on all parts that people wanted to live in diverse neighborhoods. They wanted to live in places that were somewhat integrated.
Not absolutely everyone, but yes, that there was a high sense that that a diverse neighborhood would be a positive thing. But when the rubber hit the road, very different by race.
How it actually breaks down, right?
Yeah. And so I think it's important just to know that many people in this city and the region are not living where they want to live.
Of course.
Or where they choose to live, but where they can best end up.
I was going to say, isn't that that has to be part of the conversation? It has to be part of what is afforded to people. because that's what we're seeing when we talk about segregation. And you know, sometimes it'll veer to stereotypes, like we talked at the beginning, sort of getting a negative connotation, saying that segregation equals poverty or people living. But that's not necessarily what you're looking at, because there are black middle class neighborhoods.
That's right.
You know, but we see more times than not that there is this affordability issue. That, you know, you just mentioned that some black neighborhoods don't gentrify. The rents are lower and things of that nature. And because of the inequality issue that we've talked about on this program and continue, there aren't just choices for people to say, yeah, I'm going to go live in Wicker Park. I'd love to live in Lincoln Park. That's just not afforded to people.
That's correct. And I think we have a tendency, because it's more comfortable, to want to talk about class, but class is heavily racialized, and we have, you know, a very long history in the city of Chicago. We're at the 100-year anniversary of the Great Migration that began in 1916. And I think we see that 100 years of very deliberate decisions that were made had a very real impact on where people have been able to live over time. And those patterns, the laws may have changed, but the patterns persist.
Is there any evidence that says, and you're just starting this, you're embarking on this study, but is there any evidence that says that an integrated neighborhood or living situation for a city it empowers a city or makes the city more efficient? I mean, I think of other places, New York, L.A., they have segregation issues as well, but you'll see more integrated neighborhoods, especially when in the inner city area. Is there any data that backs the fact up that integration is actually an efficient way to run a city?
Well, there's two things that I'll cite there, and I think it's worth noting that the research that we're doing at the city and the regional level is different and is new. So it's exciting to see. But, you know, what we know in other contexts is that, for instance, on a broader scale, when you look at places where high and low skill labor are not able to converge in workplaces, that economies suffer. And we know that on a broader scale, for instance, at the state level or the country level, that is the case, because the way that work is largely arranged now, you need both high and low skill to converge in one place. But if we have people living far away from those workplaces because of the kinds of segregation we've been discussing, or far from transportation that can take them to those workplaces, then you have a lot of turnover and a lot of churn in those places and unable to maximize. The other piece is that in education, there's a great deal of research that shows that in integrated schools, it is not only lower income students of color that benefit, but that increasingly we see that white and middle class students benefit from being around a diverse environment for the rest of their lives. It impacts their ability to function in college and in the workplace and so on and so forth.
Okay. And then the last thing I just want to mention before we wrap up tonight is the idea that that people of color are the way you say it, is somehow inefficient on their own. They need white people to be whole. That's a myth. I mean, a myth that sort of the idea that, well, integration means that people of color should move to white neighborhoods and that will make everybody more utopian. Talk about that myth and you know, what you guys are doing in the study to sort of deal with that.
Sure. I think this is profound, right? This is gets to the heart of some pushback on the issue of integration, is to say, who's to say that one group of people needs to live around white people in order to somehow function better in the world, right? That's inherently problematic, right? And on a personal note, you know, I lived for over a decade in North Lawndale, just a block north of Little Village. So predominantly African-American, predominantly Mexican-American, respectively. And in that time of living and working there, I never once heard from a neighbor or a coworker someone say, boy, I wish I lived around more white people. You know, what I heard them say was, I wish I could walk to a grocery store. I wish I could send my child outside without fear of violence. I wish that my school was better resourced, right? So achieving those things should not have to equate to living around white people. But because of how closely income is tied to race and how much racism still exists in housing and retail markets, in this country, unfortunately, it usually still does. So one last point on this. I think it's important to distinguish here between race and racism and not commingle the terms. So what I mean by that is there's nothing inherent about race itself, right? There's no magic or deficits with which any certain race has inherently, of course. But there is everything that is, you know, pervasive about racism. And so as long as there's gaps and disparities in wages, in wealth and health, right, and incarceration and all of those areas that are differential by race, as long as there's deep racism in housing markets and so on, then integration does need to be part of the conversation. So it's about racism.
Well, we got to check back in with you as this continues, a two-year study on the cost, essentially the cost-neutral idea of segregation. Marisa Navarra is a director at the Metropolitan Planning Council. She's my guest tonight in the How to Improve segment here on The Download. Thanks for coming in, and you got to come back.
Thanks, Justin.
Welcome back to Download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. Wow, what a year for the Chicago Cubs. It's exciting, all things Wrigleyville right now. A new photo exhibit is hitting Wrigleyville on Thursday in the G-Man Tavern north of the Metro, the former Gingerman. It's photography from longtime photographer Andy Jeffione. Came so close. I was working so hard on that. Andy documented more than 300 Cubs homes games stretching from 1996 to 1999. In that time, the Cubs made some amazing history. Whether it was a 20-strikeout game for Kerry Wood or the Sammy Sosa home run chase, the four-year period definitely was painted Cubby blue. It was also a time that featured the passing of Harry Carey and Jack Brickhouse, as well as some records in futility, as any Cubs generation would have. The exhibit is called Searching for the Pink Poodle, Life with the Cubs, 1996 to 1999. And the photographer Andy Jeffione is in studio with me now. Andy, thanks for being here.
My pleasure. My pleasure.
Let's talk about this. Where did this idea come from? It's such a specific period of time when it comes to Chicago Cubs baseball, 1996 to 1999. Where did the idea for the exhibit come from?
Well, that was the time period that I was shooting with the wonderful team photographer Steve Green. I was fresh out of the School of the Art Institute and looking to sort of get away from the art world. And I thought, you know, what is my other love? Baseball. And my first apartment was Addison Broadway. Moved there because I was close to Wrigley Field. So I was like, you know what? Let me see if I can kind of get in there and see what's doing. And met Steve Green after writing him a letter. We met and started working on some freelance stuff together. And eventually he's like, you know what? You can come assist me here and there. Little by little, I'm there every day.
And you were young. I mean,
like 22 years old.
22 years old, taking photos of Major League Baseball players. You know, I don't know much about locker rooms and the, you know, the field and how players are. But the little I do know is that they can be somewhat prickly.
That's a good word for it. I think I had a lot of naivete, which helped because I didn't really think like, oh, it's a big deal. You know, hey, if I get in the clubhouse, that's cool. If I don't, you know, I can still do my job. And I think because I sort of had this comfortable kind of attitude, I was able to be in some really special places. Like after the 98 wild card, I was in the clubhouse. I got champagned. I mean, that was a highlight to, you know, even though I'm trying to keep my gear from getting wet, it was right. Like, this is the greatest.
You know, for you, I mean, to put these photos in there, and they're really great photography of just sort of normal life. I mean, there's a lot where there's just players hanging out. Talk about what you're going for. What's your motif when you're putting together a photography exhibit about these specific 4 years?
I think being that this show is a block away from the ballpark, I really tried to curate things to tell the story of that four-block radius, you know, the Waveland, Addison, and Sheffield, Clark. I mean, the people, you know, the Ball Hawks, the fans and the bleachers. It was more than just the ball players. It was like the whole thing, Wrigley as its own entity. And I tried to really capture the best and the most storied parts of that 4 years.
It's amazing, too. We were just talking right before we went on about how that 4 years, which is really 20 years ago, and it's modern history for Chicago Cubs fans, but that four-year time stretch has so much of what Cubs history is all about, whether it be Kerry Wood's game, as we mentioned, Sammy Sosa in the home run chase, and like you said, a 98 wild card run was in there.
Amazing.
But also just, you know, a changing of the guard, if you will. Wrigley Field changed in the way that we saw different audiences, and we've seen so many different people come through there. But talk about that, because, you know, you don't think about it when you first think about the late 90s in the Chicago Cubs organization, but it was definitely a time that will be remembered.
Absolutely. I think after, you know, the 94 strike season, baseball was not exactly on everyone's thoughts. You know, people kind of were backing away from baseball. So it took some time, and it wasn't until really that 98 season that you really got the casual fans back. So 96, 97 was kind of a struggle as far as attendance, as far as playing. It was an interesting time because I think that's why I was able to do a lot of the things I was able to do. There wasn't this grand stage for the Cubs. It was kind of like, yeah, you know, Tribune was owning them, and it was kind of like, yeah, if it ain't broke, just kind of do what you do. And it opened up this area to really kind of explore the game without there being a lot going on.
What did you know as a young photographer at the School of the Art Institute? What did you know about sports photography? What did you know about the lore, even around baseball photography? Because you will see some amazing photography coming from the 70s and 80s. I have a vivid image of Reggie Jackson you know, like, and Oakland A's and that kind of thing. Like, what did you know about sports photography getting into it?
Well, you know, I always say that my love of baseball was sort of born sitting at my parents' kitchen table trying to do my homework and listening to Richie Ashburn and Harry Callis. Yeah, I grew up in Philadelphia. And I would just kind of drift off, and they would paint such a beautiful picture of the game that I was there. I was at Vet Stadium. And that's where my love started. It kind of drifted a little bit when I went to art school, and, you know, sports weren't exactly on everyone's mind. And
there probably weren't too many classes for sports journalism at the Art Institute, right?
I learned trial by fire. I learned really shooting sports while being at Wrigley Field.
And one of the things about sports photography is about action. You know, it's about, you know, catching the play, and you see that all the time. I mean, trying to get that moment where something happens. But what I really like about the exhibit is almost capturing the moments that aren't necessarily the slide in the third or the home run trot. I mean, there's something about the everyday aspect of baseball in the summer that you capture. I mean, that's the action you're going for.
Right. And I was lucky enough to learn how to pan and to shoot action, especially in an era where you couldn't look back and see what you just got. We're shooting transparency slide film. So it was all about, okay, you got a bracket for this guy. His skin tone is a little darker than this player. So
you had to adjust.
You had to adjust.
Wow.
And it wasn't until you got your film back the next day, you were like, oh, man, that would have been a terrific shot, but it's out of focus.
Yeah, right.
Underexposed. So doing that every day, really, I learned shooting sports.
I mean,
there.
It's right on the cusp, right before digital photography starts, too. It's sort of like the end of an era there.
Absolutely. I was lucky enough, because of my relationship with Steve and the Cubs, Canon loaned me some of their early digital equipment back in like 98. These giant cameras that shot like, you know, 500K image or something, and it was ridiculous. But also, on the other hand, I loved the other stories. You know, like I said, the walking around the ballpark, wandering around the bleachers, talking to people, and just getting all of those little pieces of the game.
Longtime photographer Andy Jaffaioni is in studio with me. Her exhibit is at the G-Man Tavern, which was renamed the old Gingerman, just right there where Clark and Racine come together, searching for the Pink Poodle, Life with the Cubs, 96 to 99. There's going to be a big event on Thursday night. Doors open at 6 o'clock with a special performance from Cubs organist Gary Pressey, who will be there. Andy will be there as well. We'll take a quick break. We'll come back. We'll continue our conversation here on The Download. Stay with us. It's a download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman, searching for the pink poodle, Life with the Cubs, 96 to 99. It's a new photograph, I guess you'd say photo exhibit. Longtime photographer Andy Jeffione, who is going to be at the special sort of opening at the G-Man Tavern up on Clark Street this Thursday night with a special performance from Cubs organist Gary Pressey. But this is a special four-year time we've been talking about, the idea that there's something magical about Cubs history that happened in the late 90s. It almost ended an era, because what we've seen in the last couple decades has been more, I don't want to say corporate, but a more suited-up kind of baseball experience, more in line with what you see around Major League Baseball. What your collection captures, it almost feels like it'd be in the 70s. It almost feels like it could be in the 60s, but it is, 96 through 99.
That's great. I love that. It's a reflection of the teams, too. I mean, you think of, like, Gary Gaetti. I mean, where would a Gary Gaetti fit into this current Cubs right. team? I mean, these are, like, young, fresh,
athletic
guys. And you have, you know, like, Terry Mulholland. I mean, like, these journeymen. I mean, they're that 98 team is the old beater that you just kept throwing a can of oil in. You're like, push it out. Let's see what happens. If it gets there, fantastic. I don't know if we'll be able to get back in. I love that. That 98 team was such a special team.
And there's a lot that goes into, obviously, the specialness of the 98 team, including a home run chase, which you to be able to document in photographs. I mean, at the time when that was happening, when there just seemed to be this interest once again in Chicago Cup baseball because of what Sammy Sosa was doing, what was that like to be in the building and to be capturing it?
That was really exciting. And I actually, for the first time, was getting calls like, do you think maybe you can shoot this for us? I mean, it opened up some little freelance opportunities, which as a young photographer, I was like, this is incredible. I still remember when Sosa hit the two home runs in one game, and I was in the stands talking to someone. I was like, oh, my God, there's one. And I'm running, trying to get back to the field. It was like every at-bat, people were on the edge of their seat.
Right?
He's going to do it. He's going to do it. And you had to, like, position yourself. Where are you going to be? Do you want the wide shot? Do you want the tight shot? Do you want him? You want the reaction of him coming into home plate? It was an exciting time.
And for you, I mean, also, you know, an exciting time, but also a sensitive time in the sense that some of Chicago's greats, especially around Wrigley Field, passed on. Harry Carey, Jack Brickhouse, both right one after another.
Right.
But talk about that, because you were able to capture, you know, the final days of Harry Carey, who always went down to the field, who was always a part of it. I mean, he was a part of the Cubs team. It's almost like, you know, when he passed on, a generation, an era changed.
Absolutely. It was like they lost a team member. I mean, he never knew my name, but he would always say, hey, little girl, and give me a sloppy kiss. And it was like, that's Harry Carey. That is fantastic. You know, he's like the grandfather you always wanted. I was lucky enough to be at his funeral and go to the after party at Harry Carey's, and I got to meet a lot of his family. It was really special to see him and watch him broadcast, and then just to see how he was around the players, because he was like another member of the team.
For you, Andy, I mean, to come in, to work with Steve, to be a part of this team in the way that you were taking, you know, photographs, when you look back on that, now we're coming up on 20 years and here comes the photo exhibit. I mean, do you consider yourself part of that family? Do you consider yourself as, you know, as a photographer who was there, who was learning on the fly? Are those the sort of the moments that you think about when you think about, you know, being part of a baseball family?
Absolutely. Again, it's taken me like 20 years to really understand just how incredibly lucky and important that opportunity was to see, I mean, really baseball, like we were saying, how it was, and it kind of never will really be. And it was such a special time. And yeah, I actually did feel like I was part of it. I got to know some of the guys, like Mickey Morandini was a great guy. Doug Glanville was such a smart, fun guy. Of course, Mark Grace.
Seeing
Sandberg come back. I mean, seeing Sandberg come back was great. I mean, I actually was lucky enough to shoot his retirement party. And to see him actually crack jokes and tell stories in front of his family and friends was amazing, because you never saw that side of Sandberg.
Yeah, right. It's pretty endearing to look at the photography and think about that time. For you, you know, you had the chance to also be a scoreboard operator. You were able to be in the PA booth. You know, that's, you know, you have a good relationship with Gary from that, from Gary Pressing. So, you know, the life that you had around Wrigley Field, and really an old Wrigley Field, different than what it is today. Talk about what your remembrances of it and what you will take away from that experience.
Well, I start thinking that, wow, I spent like my early adult life really at Wrigley Field. I mean, probably about 15 years of my life I spent in and around that ballpark. And it really is like a family member in a way. That experience was almost like a tangible thing because you don't just work there. It's such an emotional connection because you get involved. You get to know the people, even if it's the guy sweeping after the game. You get to know everyone, and it's a long season. You're there sometimes 15 days in a row. You have rain delays. You're there. I mean, you see a lot of these people more than your family, and you have a lot of time to sit around and talk.
For you, as you mentioned, you grew up in Philly. But you spent your young adult life at Wrigley Field. Allegiances? I mean, do you consider yourself a Cubs fan? I mean, here in 2016, as they go for it all at Wrigley Field, a different Wrigley Field, a different environment. Obviously, as you see that, it's amazing to see what Wrigley Field is today. But where are your allegiances?
You know, it's hard to say, but I have to say that there's always a part of me that the Cubs hold a big part of my heart because I really did. I saw so much and felt so much a part of the struggles and the triumphs that there's definitely a big part of my heart that is always rooting for them. But I am a baseball fan at heart, and I know people don't like to hear it. I love that there are two teams in this city. I mean, I grew up seeing ball games in a stadium with AstroTurf, so I was, right. You know, moving here, I was like, we have two teams.
Two teams.
And people are like, you can't like both teams. You got to be Sox or Cubs. And it's like, but I didn't grow up here, so yeah. Can I like them both?
Yes, you can. Don't let the bullies bully. Last question I have for you is just searching for the pink poodle. I'm not a huge baseball aficionado when it comes to legend. Talk about the pink poodle.
That was a nickname for the old press dining room. And I know guys like Jack Brookhouse and Harry Carey, they would go in and actually have a cocktail at the Pink Poodle after the game, and all the sports writers. And apparently they kind of had to get rid of the cocktail program because, let's be honest, sports writers sometimes overindulge. And they said, you know what, we're losing a lot of money here. Let's dial it back.
We either can charge $12 for these cocktails or get rid of it. Let's get rid of it. That's what happened. All right. The exhibit is called Searching for the Pink Poodle, Life with the Cubs, 96 to 99. It's the photographs of Andy Jaffioni. She will be at the G-Man Tavern, which is right north of Metro on Clark Street, right across from the ballpark. On Thursday night, doors open at 6 o'clock. There'll be a special performance from Cubs organist Gary Pressey. Andy, thanks so much for coming in and talking about the exhibit, and good luck with it up at the G-Man.
Thank you so much. It's my pleasure.
I feel like I can remember watching that Cubs. Who did they play? Giants? Who did they play in that wild card game? Was it Giants? It's always the Giants. It's always got to be the Giants. I'm getting sick of the Giants. Yes. Anyway, remember, Gary Gaetti hit a big home run in that game. There you go.
It's still going.
It's still going. That's right. All right. Coming up, Adam Green's going to join us. One half of Moldy Peaches, the anti-folk duo that had a tremendous, tremendous career. He is a filmmaker as well. His Adam Green's Aladdin was just released, and it is definitely getting great reviews, but it's also just a tour de force. I mean, it's essentially him, Macaulay Culkin, a couple others in New York City, holing up in a warehouse and creating this just vivid, I don't even know the words to describe it, almost like a play/film based on the world of Aladdin. Welcome back to The Download here on WGN Radio. I'm Justin Kaufman. Well, my next guest is a singer-songwriter, visual artist, and filmmaker. Adam Green hails from the anti-folk music scene in New York City. He first grabbed critical acclaim for his work with Moldy Peaches, the duo who was featured in the 2008 movie Juno.
You're a part-time lover and a full-time friend. The monkey on your back is the latest trend. I don't see what anyone can see in anyone else.
kiss you on the brain in the shadow of the train. Kiss you all starry-eyed, my body swinging from side to side. I don't see what anyone can see in anyone else. But
Green has been a solo act for years now, garnering not only great press, but big audiences here in the U.S. and in Europe. Green started off in music, but he quickly added visual art to his resume with art shows all over New York City in the last decade. And he just released his second film, Adam Green's Aladdin, which was released last month and stars Green, Macaulay Culkin, and Natasha Lyonne, among others. Adam was just in town for a show at the Beat Kitchen, and he is my guest in studio tonight. Adam Green, welcome to The Download.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
And I'm a big fan of your work. I mean, you wear so many different hats. I mean, do you consider yourself one genre over another? Do you consider yourself a musician more than a filmmaker, or a filmmaker more than an artist?
Yeah, I mean, I'm trying to include them all. And, you know, for the movie, the Aladdin movie, I got to do all the aspects in one package. You know, I got to write the soundtrack.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the movie is made out of paper mache, so I got to build with like visual art and painting the sets, and then I got to write the script and be in it myself. So it kind of felt like, you know, this kind of idea of like a complete artwork or something.
Was that the goal when you were setting out to do Adam Green's Aladdin? Was the goal to be able to bring all those things together in your life?
Yeah, because, you know, the more you start thinking of them as synthesized, you know, you start you know, learning about painting, and you realize that maybe you think of sound as being fibrous or having texture, or like you start to think of smell like it's paintings, or, you know, I don't know. I mean, and it's kind of easy to bridge those disciplines the more that you, try to think about them like that way.
Well, let's talk about Adam Green's Aladdin. I mean, what was it about this story, the Aladdin story, that brought you to the idea of doing, I guess this is a remake or just a different telling of the story?
Right. You know, the Aladdin story is really classic. It's like a 1,000-year-old tale from, I think, Iraq. So it's, there's a very old text that you can look at. I mean, that's where I started. I actually tried to insert as many lines as I could from the original old story into the movie script. But, you know, I wanted to make it a modern version. So in my version, the lamp is a 3D printer, and the genie is sort of like the Siri interface of that printer, and the princess is like a decadent socialite, like a, you know, sort of like princess is basically a Kardashian.
Yeah, well, I mean, it plays to the concepts of pop culture and what we know of celebrity, like with the princess, but it also plays to this idea of our obsession with technology.
Mm-hmm.
That was something when you talk about modernizing the story, it fits well with Aladdin.
Yeah, I mean, kind of the idea is like if you took the internet and then you plugged it into a 3D printer and you were just like, go, and then it just printed out the entire internet and there was no room for it on the planet. You know, I mean, that was my sort of inspiration for making the movie. I mean, just kind of a culture of overproduction, you know, not valuing privacy, not reminding ourselves that we value it, you know, and just in general, I mean, the stuff that everyone thinks about with cell phones, cell phone culture makes a lot of fun of that.
Adam Green's my guest in studio. He's a musician, visual artist, filmmaker. His second film, Adam Green's Aladdin, is out now. It was released last month. It stars Green himself, Macaulay Culkin, Natasha Lyonne.
Oh, and you know, also, you know, a bunch of musicians, you know, because like, this is kind of fun for me as being a musician that makes a movie. I got to, you know, have Harm, our superstar, in it. Devendra Banhart, Andrew Van Wingarden from MGMT. You know, musicians and actors like to hang out with each other, but I think people don't get to see it.
That's where I wanted to go with it, was this idea that, you know, it really does, it's a reflection of the New York City scene that you hang. You know, all the people you've been in art collectives with, Macaulay Culkin or, mm-hmm. or Natasha Lyonne, you worked with. Just the idea through music, through art, through video, through film, you have created, there's just this artist collective that's bubbling up in New York City.
You know, for example, you know, I started this art group with Macaulay Culkin and Toby Goodshank, who I was mm-hmm. in The Moldy Peaches with, and Jack Dischel, who I was in The Moldy Peaches with. He plays actually two parts in the movie. All the extension of the script is sort of the way that, you know, that we hang out. I mean, for example, Macaulay Culkin, you know, before he was in the movie, he like knew a lot of his lines already because he knew, you know, he watched me write the script.
Because you guys were hanging out together,
yeah,
right?
He saw me draw. He knew what the rooms would look like.
Right.
You know, it's a community project in the sense that people really did it for, you know, free over the summer. And it was sort of like I was trying to create an environment in a warehouse in Brooklyn. It was, you know, where we built 30 sets. And it was kind of like, come be inside of a real-life cartoon in this remote neighborhood in Brooklyn. And, you know, I think that was a hard thing to refuse.
How did you – I mean, you, this is your second film. I keep saying this. In the first film, you shot it all on an iPhone.
Yeah.
Talk about the lessons learned about putting a film together, because, you know, I've read that you learned some lessons and you organized this differently.
Yeah, well, the first movie, The Wrong Ferrari, you know, it has actually a lot of repeating cast from, you know, from this movie.
Yeah,
but
same crew, right.
But I filmed The Wrong Ferrari on tour, and I filmed it with an iPhone because that was the camera that I knew how to use, and that was actually useful because we were traveling around and I was writing the scenes like every day. You know, the actors didn't even know what they were going to be doing until that very day. I'd give them index cards and they would like do that scene. This movie, I spent 4 years making, planned out every single thing, how everything looked. I had like every object drawn. Everything was written as a script. I mean, actually, a lot of the actors from the old movie said that they wouldn't be in the new movie unless I wrote a script.
That's so, what you learned.
Yeah, but you know, but also, you know, editing and scoring. I mean, you know, even when I recorded the soundtrack to Aladdin, that stuff was with, I had a band of Stella from Warpaint and Rodrigo Amarante from Little Joy and Josiah Steinbrick, who plays in Devendra's band. And we recorded half an hour's worth of music, and I learned that was not enough to score a movie at all.
Really?
I mean,
so,
that was,
yeah, this was something new, yeah, scoring the movie.
So I ended up digging into, like, I had old mixes of songs I did in the past with strings, like orchestra parts, and I was, like, taking the instrumental parts from old songs.
I was going to ask, which came first? I mean, the script and the idea for the film or the soundtrack for you as a musician and a filmmaker, did they go in a certain order?
Yeah, well, you know, I wrote the script. So I was starting writing the script and, you know, traveling around, on an iPad and trying to do all this stuff and... when I finished writing the script, the first thing I did then was record the soundtrack, because I thought there's no way that I'm going to finish this entire movie and then want to go to like LA for a month and record music. You know, I was just like, let's just get this done. Plus, it felt like I kept on firmly cementing myself in the commitment to do the movie with a Kickstarter as well, because the project began as a Kickstarter. So that was another firm commitment to people that I was going to make it.
I was going to say, does that help in the way as an artist, as someone who's creative and you work on a lot of different projects, to have a Kickstarter where people have invested in you to do this project? It gives you sort of a deadline, right?
Yeah, I mean, you know, I did miss the deadline, I mean, in my own mind, but I didn't realize the complexity of it. I mean, you know, even the special effects for the movie took so long. You know, but yeah, I think that that's good, you know, as an artist, definitely to tell people that you're going to do something. And maybe I find myself sometimes telling people I'm going to do something just so that I will do it.
It's so creative, and you talked a lot about creativity and as an artist of being able to express your vision or execute your vision the way you want to. And in commerce, in mainstream art in any form, it becomes harder and harder to do that with so many different people putting their hands in. What if you change this character? What if you've done that? And one of the things about your career, which has been tremendously, I mean, successful, is the fact that you stick to what you want the vision to be and you execute.
Yeah, thanks. I mean, that I do think that for me the goal is to make something that I picture in my head and sort of project it like outside of myself in the state that I imagine it. And so I don't really question it. If it looks cool in my head, I'm like, let's do it. But at the same time, yeah, I mean, it's not like a commercial thing. I mean, people can actually get the movie, by the way. I mean, it's not at adamgreensaladdin.com, I should mention. You can watch it.
You were from New York City. I mean, you grew up in the New York area. Talk about that, because it's we've had different New York comedians on. We talked about the Brooklyn comedy scene and how that's coming up. But in your case, I mean, the anti-folk scene and not only that, but now with the visual art scene. I mean, you've immersed yourself in so many different areas. Talk about the community and how you're able to work in New York City.
It's, you know, when I got started, the Sidewalk Cafe was sort of the center of this anti-folk thing, and it was basically this excellent open mic where, you know, you could go and play your songs every Monday night, and there was an amazing group of people that were there at that time. Regina Spektor, you know, it was really, really impressive people, and, you know, and
all getting up on a Monday night doing an open
mic. Yeah, exactly, you know, and everyone's just trying to write new songs to basically, you know, just to impress each other, you know, and it was really cool. And so that for me became, I guess, like a scene that I was, you know, that I was part of. And I think that as the open mic continues, you know, every few years, there's a different group. And for those people, that's their group. Mm-hmm. But I'm still in touch with the people that were from like my class of anti-folk.
And when you say anti-folk, for those listening here, you know, what does that mean? What's the anti-folk music scene describing?
You know, anti-folk originally, the premise is started as like an acoustic punk hybrid, kind of in response to the West Village folk scene, which was at that time like very kind of, you know, a throwback. So, yeah, so there was a sort of a more aggressive and, like, immediate, what do you want to call it, abrasive New York folk scene mm-hmm. that was, like, I guess basically people that would be writing poetry but set it to punk music and stuff. And, you know, and so I think the word, it's like with words, they're never really that important. You know, it's like, I feel like all the art movements have, you know, are hippies really hip? You know, I don't know. So it's just a word, but I like it. I welcome it because it actually, it's one, at least the kind of thing had a name and people can refer to it somehow. And that's, if you don't have any name, maybe people can't even consider it at all. So
well, I'm always fascinated and love to have these conversations on the show just about how scenes flourish. And in New York City, I think about all the things that are standing in your way, whether it be the expense to live there, which is a huge thing. The idea that a lot of artists that are there to make money and to get into commerce. We've talked to Broadway artists who are uncomfortable with the idea that the only way they're going to make it is if they go into this Broadway thing. So how do you keep yourself independent? How do you keep yourself on that, you know, artistic vision or what you want to do in a city like New York?
I guess it kind of is a multi-part thing. Like, I think that the reason why that scene flourished is also because Latch, you know, who's sort of was sort of the MC of this thing for so long, and he's a songwriter, you know, and like he really publicized anti-folk, and he, you know, he really wanted it to be known about, you know, and he did it along with himself and the whole group of people. So, you know, we continued sort of promoting anti-folk, even though it was a 10-year-old movement when we joined it, you know, and. In regards to, you know, how it flourished, I think that, or why, just that people didn't have in Manhattan, like, the kind of real estate to have a full band.
Mm-hmm.
So people with doing, like, acoustic guitar stuff, it was, like, really appealing for people who live in, like, tiny apartments. There's, like, no place to rehearse or anything.
So you really got to learn to be able to perform smaller.
Yeah, you know, and actually, a lot of the stuff I'm talking about is really before anyone had cell phones. I mean, so it was actually, like, I remember when you were playing, that you weren't scared that, like, people were going to get a call in the middle of your show.
Right.
So it was a little quieter.
Right. That's always a good thing, right? Well, the movie is Adam Green's Aladdin. You can find it at adamgreensaladdin.com, right? That's where you can find the movie. He's on tour right now. He's just put out the soundtrack as well to the movie. The Aladdin soundtrack can be found everywhere, iTunes. Adam Green, solo artist, also part of Moldy Peaches. Adam, I can't thank you enough for taking some time out to talk to us.
Oh, tonight. Yeah. Well, thank you so much. And, so see you next time.
Killing it on the music tonight, Pete Zimmerman. Give it up. Coming up, Doug Plank, good old number 46, going to join us. Let's talk about anything else. Let's just ask him about politics, maybe the environment. Ask him about education, what he thinks of Common Core. Anything. It's like, you know, being the last one, like we're the caboose. You know, like, I mean, we've pummeled Chicago today. Not just this radio station, but the newspapers, sports radio, pummeled. Because it's, at this point, 24 hours later, it is still unfathomable to me. Like, I'm still, like, flabbergasted at how just painful and ill-prepared the Chicago Bears were in their home opener at Soldier Field. I mean, it's amazing. Like, I was watching bunch of the highlights and stuff today, and I was just scratching my head at some of the things. The Bears have been here before. I remember there were a couple of years back when I think it was Cutler and the offensive line just did. I think it was in a Monday Night Football game in Detroit. They were all excited because the Lions finally got a Monday Night game and they're going to beat the Bears. Remember this? And it was something where it was like false start, delay game, false start, sack. You know, like it was like a 6-play in futility. Like, it was just, like, the worst thing. Like, the crowd noise had rattled Jay Cutler. That's a terrible moment in Chicago Bears history, and I believe last night was worse. Let's go ahead and get rid of that. Sorry. That's a fight song. We watched a team yesterday with no fight, right?
Need more like a dirge.
Yeah, we need something a little bit more morose. Do you have, I don't know, like an Elliott Smith or something you could jam. Not a good showing yesterday in front of a national audience for the Chicago Bears. Their home opener at Soldier Field turned into quite a show, not in a good way, more like a train wreck, as the Bears not only lost to Philadelphia, but lost several of their key players to key injuries. Joining us on the line, joins us after every Bears game here on the download, Doug Plank, the Bears safety, the great Bears safety, number 46. Doug Plank, I cannot imagine that you were satisfied with that game yesterday.
You know what? Honestly, I really appreciate the energy of the guys after the game, because, you know, it's really fresh in your mind at that time after what you've just seen. And I know how disappointed they were. And just listening to Dan and Ed and, you know, it was just a tough experience doing that and watching that game. And, you know, and I have to agree with him. You know, it wasn't just the mistakes, the turnovers. You know, you're watching a Monday night game. On Monday night, you understand that everybody in the country is watching you, including all your players around the league, one of the teams. And what you want to do is you want to try to impress them any way you can, with extra effort, big plays, and on top of everything else that went wrong. You know, to me, the most demoralizing thing was just watching the team, and they looked like they were, I'm not saying just going through the motions, but there was nothing extra there. There was nothing that really gave you any hope, like, wow, okay, they maybe had a bad play, but, you know, look at the effort. They're hustling, and they're hitting, and they're doing all the things that Chicago Bears teams do, and I just didn't see it. I mean, it was so nondescript, you know, afterwards, just talking to, you know, many, many friends that are just obviously huge Bear fans. You know, some of them didn't even watch the game all the way in its entirety just because they were so frustrated. Yeah.
And including some of the fans, there was a lot of stories today about walkouts leaving in the fourth quarter disgusted. I think you hit the nail on the head there, Doug. It just seems like the intensity, the emotion, the things, the intangibles that go along with the game of football, where you want to see heart and soul left on the field, what the Chicago Bears are known for. Was missing yesterday. And a lot of that starts and stops with the quarterback. Jay Cutler, once again, had a subpar game, including some mind-numbing mistakes at the exact wrong time, which is starting to become his calling card. But it just seems to me, let's start there, Jay Cutler's performance was erratic at best.
You know what? And let's face it. You know, I think I mentioned to you, if you have just one turnover, it increases your chances from 50-50 up to almost 90%. You're in the 88-89%. When you get two turnovers, you know, it gets into like the 94-95%. So those turnovers are so important. Those are the second most important things that happen on a football field, other than the scoring. It's the turnovers. Because, number one, not only do they give the ball to the other team and give them a chance to score, but it's the psychological. You know, it really just runs your team down. And you're walking off the field, you know, just in an absolute depression because you turn the ball over. And especially against a team like Philadelphia, you know, they looked kind of more like the Bears team that everybody thought. You know, physical, making big plays and tackles and all that sort of thing. But I think really, you know, just – as I said before, I think, you know, that they came into the game, I think, better prepared with a better game plan as far as misdirection and executing offense and defense.
Well, Doug, let me ask you about, I mean, before we get into sort of laying the blame at the feet of the Chicago Bears, the Philadelphia Eagles defense now has had two strong weeks. They shut down a Cleveland Browns team and knocked out RG3. And then, of course, knocked out Jay Cutler here in Chicago. But the Philly D, I mean, from a national perspective, it's pretty good. It's pretty solid. It may be one of the better units in the league.
Yeah, there's no doubt. I mean, you know, both, you know, Houston as well as the Philadelphia team. I mean, obviously, you know, they've had a reputation over the years for playing very physical and tough. And I think they did that. I really do. You know, I think the frustration most of the Bear fans had, and they're okay playing against a good team and a good defense, but, you know, don't try to make something out of a play that isn't there. And I think too many times, you know, in the game last night, you know, there were times where, okay, just take the check down or, you know, don't try to overdo the play. And I think the Bears really got caught in a situation where, you know, they needed to just play smart and not try to force the football.
Yeah. You know, staying on the offensive side, obviously Alshon Jeffery played a good game again where he was able to catch a deep ball, which gave the Bears a touchdown, set up a touchdown. But talk about that, because it seems, and I read something today about the concept that the Bears offense, and this goes to Dow Loggins, the offensive coordinator as well, has really it's make or break on the deep ball, this sort of lob throw to Alshon Jeffrey. And other than that, we're not seeing much when it comes to creativity or moving the ball around or even moving Jay Cutler out of the pocket. It seems like that's the play. The teams adjust to it, and then the Bears look like they're lost.
You know what, though? Alshon Jeffrey, he really did an outstanding job. I don't want to just throw a blanket over everybody and say they all did. I mean, the individual effort that he made in timing and bringing down the ball and securing it, I mean, it was outstanding. And, you know, I think he ended up averaging like 11 or 12 yards a catch. And some of those were outstanding. I mean, he just ended up taking them away for the defensive backs. Mm-hmm. It wasn't just one. It was two or three times. So, I mean, you can't say enough about the job that he did. You know, what they did, though, they took away all the short patterns so that when Jay got into a situation where he's trying to hit a 5 or 10 yard, you know, throw down, check down route, it wasn't there. So he had to hold on to the ball. And after I saw him get hit a few times, I said, you know what, he cannot take these type of hits too many more times. And then ultimately, you know, there at the end of the third quarter, that was it. He was got hit in the hand and was injured, and it was over.
You know, obviously there's a lot has been made about halftime adjustments. And as we stay and we wrap up on the offense, because I do want to go to the defense too. But the halftime adjustment, we've seen both games now where the Chicago Bears in the second half have been shut down. Offensively,
yes.
We saw Jay Cutler obviously left the game. That had a big part of it. But even before that, it seemed like it was a carbon copy of last week where – you know, he was getting hit. I mean, he got hit with the fumble. We started to see turnovers. It was, you know, it just seemed like the Bears in some way on the offensive side of the ball are overmatched with halftime adjustments.
You know what? I have to agree with you 100%. I mean, I think, you know, the success in the National Football League is, you know, you come out, you try to find out what's going on in the first half, what the other team is trying to do against you. You have to go in and you have to make adjustments. I mean, it sounds kind of crazy, but, you know, sometimes if you're playing very well, then you just go into the locker room and the coach just says, okay, keep doing what you've been doing. On the other hand, if you're struggling, then he needs to get on that board and start putting in different plays. So you go into every game with more than just one game plan. You have to be able to have a game plan and react to what circumstances and situations are. You know, whether the team played man-to-man defense in the front first half and then zone in the second, whatever, you have to make adjustments and make that accordingly. And it just looked to me like Philadelphia had more situations, more plays on both offense and defense where they looked like the Bears were astounded, like they were confused.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't know where to go. They didn't know who to block. And Jay was getting some hard rushes from the outside, and he was getting hit hard. And there was nobody even blocking several of the guys that came in either in through the middle or on the outside. And then on the flip side, you know, what they started doing with the defense was throwing, you know, making it look like a quick screen and throwing running motion across, running a receiver or a running back across the formation, and it was confusing the Bear defense.
Where does that come from? I mean, Doug, tell us as a player, I mean, when you're getting free outside rushes to the quarterback, is that on the line? Is that on the center? Is that at the quarterback not picking up coverage? Like, whose fault is it that the guys are coming unblocked, unimpeded to the quarterback?
You know what? It's like basically the offense has two blocking assignments. They can block man where everybody calls out a man at the line of scrimmage to block. On the other hand, sometimes they slide, which means that if the line slides right, you know, and then there's going to be a guy coming off the left, you know, off the mm-hmm. backside, and the running back has to pick him up. I suspect in that situation when there was confusion from the running back as well as one of the tackles, because that guy came unobstructed off the edge. I mean, Jay really, really got hit. I mean, he doesn't like to show when he's in pain, but I think that, you know, that one happened early in the game.
Yeah.
That guy really, really put a solid hit on.
That was like the second play of the game. Doug Blank on the line with us. We're talking Bears. We'll take a quick break, come back and talk about the defense and talk about the injuries and what the Bears' plan is to replace some very key guys that went down last night. It's a download here on 720 WGN. Stay with us.
Chicago Professional American Football Team in Chicago, member of the North Division of the National Football Conference in the National Football League. Chicago! Chicago Bears! Chicago Bears!
It's The Download here on 720 WGN. Doug Plank with me on the line. We're talking about the Bears game last night. 312-981-7200. If you'd like to contribute to the conversation, comment. Doug, I got a text that came in and said, all well said, guys, but the Eagles quarterback, he was a rookie. Talk about that. I mean, obviously Carson Wentz had a big game yesterday, but it wasn't the greatest when you look at the stats line. He only threw for 150 yards or something like that. But he did not play like a rookie, and the Bears didn't force him into rookie mistakes.
No, you know, and look at the game plan. And we talked about the coaching staff. You know, every coaching staff has to understand who they have as players. And they, I think, gave him an awesome game plan. It wasn't too difficult. He didn't have to hold on to the football. He was throwing relatively short passes. But you know what? It was a good tempo. And the Eagles quickly just got into the theme and the role of that offense, and they were all contributing. You know, you look at them, if you didn't know which quarterback was the more seasoned quarterback and you were looking at that game, you would think that that was Wentz instead of on the other side with Chicago Bears. Jay was back there running around, struggling, trying to find receivers. You know, even some of those long passes he threw were just Hail Mary passes downfield. So, you know, you have to give a lot of credit. I think the Eagles came into that game with really a good game plan, and they made it better at halftime. They made the adjustments and really, really put the pressure on the Bears.
Okay, so let's talk about the Bears' defense. Obviously, a lot of injuries have been – and. But let's start with the front seven. Not a lot of pressure on Carson Wentz. Did the Eagles dial up good protection? Or what was the issue with the Bears not able to get at the rookie quarterback?
Well, I think, number one, you know, when you have a young quarterback, try to take the pressure off him, you know, try to run the football. They didn't necessarily do that a lot, but they did run play action, you know, which slowed up the defense. And the other thing I really, really liked, you know, they started moving the ball, getting it out of his hands, throwing quick screens, short passes. You know, then they were running, you know, what John Gruden was calling jet motion. Jet motion is just very flat motion right down the line of scrimmage, and a receiver or a split running back does it. And what it does is it forces the defense to change their calls. And what the offense does, when they start making those adjustments over there, they can usually tell whether they're in zone defense or in man-to-man defense. And the Eagles really, really picked up on it.
Yeah. Okay, let's talk about the linebacking play. Obviously, Terrell Freeman and Danny Trevathan had good games again in the inside. But in the outside linebackers, obviously Willie Young, Lamar Houston, who was injured, and also Leonard Floyd. They played okay. I mean, you saw them around the ball, but not the kind of impact that you want to see more from those players.
No, they weren't dominating. I mean, you know, we think of linebackers, everybody goes back to the mid-'80s, watching linebackers coming off the edge, Wilbur Marshall and Otis Wilson and guys like that, just destroying the other team. And we didn't see that. But, you know, I really like the outside linebackers and inside linebackers we have. I think they're physical. I think they're smart. But again, I watched them, you know, they were trying to make reads on what, you know, the Eagles offense were doing. They were doing a great job moving those linebackers around, getting them to bite on something that was really just a decoy, mm-hmm. and then throwing the ball in the other direction. So, you know, a lot of those things that they created were by scheme, and I have to give their coaching staff a lot of credit.
The obvious issue, of course, is injuries. We saw so many injuries. Obviously, Jay Cutler was a big one, but on the defensive side,
yes,
tremendous loss for Eddie Goldman, the defensive tackle who injured an ankle, was carted off the field today. They said 4 weeks on an ankle. Lamar Houston tore an ACL, second time in 3 years with the Bears. He's out for the season. You saw Bryce Callahan got a concussed. Adrian Amos was out for a while there, the safety. Just seemed like when it rained, it poured when it came to the injuries on the defensive side of the ball.
You know, it's not good. And, you know, I've heard a lot of Bear fans today, you know, they were really, really frustrated with not just the loss, but, you know, what happened starting with the quarterback. You know, then you start going over the defensive side of the football. And just like you did, Justin, you start going down there. I mean, anytime anybody tears an ACL injury, obviously they're lost for the season. You know, that ankle that Goldman suffered, you know, you don't just come bouncing back from injuries like that. A lot of times you can have either a fracture, it's called an avulsion fracture, where like a ligament attached to a bone pulls off, or you just super hyperextend your ankle. And those things are really hard to play fast on. And the DBs, you know, I like the DBs. They were active. I mean, they were aggressive.
Yeah, they broke up a couple plays.
They had some good hits, you know. So the concussions, I understand it. I get it. you know, when you hit somebody that hard, you're going to get a concussion. And Amos, you know, and I like Callahan, too. I think he's a good player. You know, I think he really reacts well. But, again, I just think that what the Eagles were doing was just enough to get everybody slowed down. They couldn't find the ball. You know, they were running misdirection. And it was just enough to create some gaps and seams on the short passing game as well as the running game for the Eagles to continually to time, you know, possess the ball. They had significant advantage in time of possession.
All right, Doug, let's talk about what's next. Obviously, they got the Dallas Cowboys on Sunday Night Football, so another mainstream America event to watch the Chicago Bears. What do you do if, I mean, you've been in this situation as a player, but what do you do when four or five of your starting comrades, you know, are out? Where what do the Bears do to prepare with so many injuries?
You know what? It's really, really going to be up to the coaching staff to really just keep everybody in a very positive mindset. You know, I read a statistic, you know, that if you lose the first two games of the year, you only have a 12% chance of getting into the playoffs, 12%. So, but that's still better than nothing. I mean, you still have a chance. I mean, there were teams last year that started out losing 0-2 and still made it. I think it was Houston and Seattle, if I'm not mistaken. They lost their first two games of the year last year, still made it to the playoffs. But, you know, you start looking at who else is winless right now. Well, you got Buffalo, you got Miami, and Cleveland, and Jacksonville. And the three surprises are really Indianapolis, Washington, and New Orleans. But the bottom line is, you know, it's about who you play and when you're playing them. And obviously Dallas is not going to be an easy team up. But, you know, it's going to be up to the coaching staff. These guys got to get amnesia. They got to forget about these first two wins, and they got to go out there and get aggressive. And here's the most important thing I saw from watching last night, Justin. You have to play to win instead of playing not to lose. And to me, just watching parts of that game, it looked more like the latter than the former.
Always insightful, the legend, Doug Plank, number 46, the greatest safety to ever play. Chicago Bears.
Hey, that's why I love you for a co-host, Justin.
Doug,
you're my man.
Thanks so much for joining us. You join us every night after the Bears play. This week was Monday night. Next week he'll join us next Monday. Doug, have a great week, and we'll talk to you next week.
Thank you. Yeah, hope we're talking about a win.
Yeah.
Thanks.
Thank you, Rob. Justin Kaufman here, the Download 720 WGN. With you till 11 o'clock tonight. We got coming up at 10 o'clock, Michael Clayton McCarthy and Amy Guth in studio to ride shotgun for the worst. 312-981-7200. We are complaining about the worst things in our society for prizes. I love that line. It's so true. I like it to be cathartic. You know, we all have this streak where we like to complain, so why not complain collectively? And why not complain for a pizza? You can get a pizza for your complaints. 312-981-7200 is the number. We'll do that coming up at 10 o'clock. Good thing we got that. I feel better talking to Doug. Like, I was really down. Today I was just like, it was annoying, like the Stephen A. Smith stuff about Jay Cutler, and then watching the ESPN coverage of it. USA Today doing the dumpster fire column. Like, I just felt really down about the Chicago Bears. Yeah, you know, I was like, this is terrible. This is the worst. And talking to Doug, it's true. It's bad.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't know. As I said, I mean, I. What are you going to do Sundays now that you got your Sundays open? Maybe that's the silver lining here for everyone out here in WGN land. The silver lining is maybe we have an extra couple hours to kill.
Well, the games on this weekend, the games on Sunday nights, I'll watch that for sure. Mm. If they lose horribly, you're not watching the Sunday night game?
I will watch for work because I have to talk to Doug about it. I'm going to tape it. I'm probably going to go to Offest, which is the show in Union Park, which is Common's show. I want to see that show. Right? It's 7 o'clock on Sunday night.
Oh.
It's opposite the Bears game. I know. It's a tough call. But part of me is I want to watch the season premiere of Bob's Burgers, and then I'm going to go to a concert, and then I will come back, and if I feel like it, I will DVR. I will turn the DVR on.
Really?
Yeah.
Now, so will you check the score?
I won't check the score. Because I'll be at a concert. I won't need to. Hopefully I won't have to pull my phone out at all. Unless there's a slow song. You know, you got to light it up like the old lighters. No. I'm interested. I think the Ahfest, A-H-H-H Fest, is one of my favorite festivals. Someone asked the great party game when I was in L.A. We were hanging out at the pool. Not a big deal. Diana asked, what was your favorite concert? And I was like, I think the Ahfest 2 years ago was maybe my favorite concert of all time. I went on a whim to see it. There weren't a lot of people there. It wasn't packed. And it was Common and Rhymefest, and it was a hip-hop show. And Kanye West came on stage, the Kanye West, and he did a whole set. It was a surprise guest. And I was like, wow. I looked around the room, the you know, where they do it at Union Park, and it wasn't full. And you could spread out, and it wasn't like every 16-year-old kid with his shirt off, like, I drank too much, like at Pitchfork. You know, everyone, like, had a jacket on. It was fall. You felt really like, oh, this is nice. This is nice. This is really nice. So I had a really good time. And this year, the headliner is J. Cole. I like J. Cole. Common, of course, Rhymefest. And they just announced tonight that Ice Cube, the Ice Cube, is going to be on stage Sunday at Union Park. So to me, I'm like, yeah, that might be worth getting rid of the Bears. Because I don't know if I can watch the Bears. I wanted to make it a big deal with my son to say, watch the Bears, but I don't know if I'm going to want to watch, you know, what's his name, Hoyer? Brian Hoyer?
Yeah,
Brian, isn't Brian?
Something like that.
I wanted to call him Jed, but that's the Bears guy, right? Or the Cubs guy. Jed Hoyer.
Brian Hoyer, yeah.
Or is Brian Hoyer the quarterback, or is he the GM for the Cubs?
Quarterback. Yeah, sorry. I feel like your son's going to see this, and he's going to say, like, well, then it's okay. It's okay that I'm not interested. You got to set a better example. Yeah.
Well, the good news is that he wants to see Bob's Burgers. So, you know, he's actually going to be off the hook. You know, it's football in a strange time.
Yeah.
Sunday night. True. You know what I mean? Like, he's getting ready for school.
Different.
Doesn't really, yeah. I don't think he's going to be that disappointed that he didn't have to watch the Bears instead of the Simpsons. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
But I could change my mind as we go. I wanted to go. I just haven't been able to pull the trigger. I mean, it's part of me too. It's like, I'm just getting old. You know, you get to a certain point where I would like to go see outdoor festivals. I think that's kind of a fun thing. And I think we talked with Abraham on Nerds on Tour, where just after a while, you're like, ugh. Like, so Chance the Rapper's got his big show, the Coloring Book Festival, which is at the Cell at Comiskey, New Comiskey. New Guaranteed Rate Comiskey, somewhere in there.
Can register yourself to vote?
Yeah, is that what it is? But that's my point. Like, I'm gonna walk in there and be like, where are the seats, guys? You know, him and Lil Wayne and others be like, I don't really want to see this one. Wait, I've got row J. I think you might be in my seats, young fella. You know what I mean? Like, what do you... I don't know. I just feel like I may have aged myself out of that kind of concert.
That's all right.
And Ahfest, what I liked about it was a lot of people were in their 30s and 40s. Like, it wasn't 16-year-old kids.
Yeah.
So I think the Chance one's going to be a little bit more 16-year-old kids. Yeah?
Yeah, probably. I would say so.
Yeah, so I'll probably not check that one out. But yeah, so anyway, I may skip the Bears for... But, I mean, that's a good reason to skip.
That is. Yeah.
To see Ice Cube do two songs and leave.
No.
Well, it's one of those lineups. We're going to be talking with Chicago hip-hop artist Tink, T-I-N-K, a great female rapper who will be part of Ahfest on Sunday. We'll talk with her tomorrow or Thursday, I forgot. But, I mean, it's one thing to me, they put so many different artists on that lineup that the artists do mini sets. They don't really do the full 1 hour kind of set. You know, they'll do like more like a 30-minute set. 4 or 5 songs and get off stage. Almost like they used to do. Did you ever go when you were a kid to a B96 jam or like a XRT? XRT does it too, where they have like a special concert in the morning and it's like your favorite band.
Yeah.
And they only play three songs.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's what it's got. I think that's what it's going to be like.
So does it start? It starts at night?
It starts at like maybe 4 or 5 o'clock.
Oh, so it's not like an all day thing either.
Yeah. Maybe it starts earlier. I think the prime time is.
Yeah, the people are.
But I'm just one person. I mean, going to the office, it's very simple for me because it's not very far from my house. It's an easy walk. it's something I could do and come back home if I don't like it. You know, it's a,
yeah.
But I mean, if you're if what I mean, that should be the call in segment. We should ask people, what are they doing with their free time? Now, if they're going to watch the Bears anymore, what are you going to do with your Sundays? 630 says, will not watch or emotionally invest in the Bears until they're a 500 team. I've been waiting for a long time on that one.
See, I mean, this is...
You don't like this. You don't like where we're going here, Pete.
I don't, and...
Is it too fair weather? What's your thought on it?
Yeah, I mean, you know, I'm a Cubs fan, and, you know, obviously, the Cubs had all my life lean years with occasional three or four decent years, but I've always followed them. Did I watch every game? I mean, there was a couple of years ago, I probably didn't watch every game, whereas now I am... Every game I can on the weekends, I'm watching.
Right.
So, yeah, I do sense, I feel there's a little bit of fair weatherness in this, in
well,
that the
possible?
Bears season is only 16 games long.
And there's only two games have been played. They could easily come back, win 3 in a row, be 3-2, and they're back in it. And they're in a division. We kind of talked about this Monday night before the game, where the Vikings are hurt. Adrian Peterson, although he did not, they say he's not out for the year, which is crazy.
He said he might play this week.
They're just like, they're not real legs at this point. They've played,
really?
He's had so many surgeries and stuff, they're just half robot. They're like, nah, we'll just need to tweak it up. Like I said, man, it'd be a much better game with robots. I think the Packers show a lot of weakness. They barely were able to beat the Jaguars. They lost to the Vikings without Adrian Peterson. The Lions have shown to be lion-like. So to me, I don't know. I feel like the Bears should be there, but after watching yesterday, there was something emotionally wrong with it.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we didn't lose by that much. We were in the game late. I mean, you could easily spin this story to say, yeah, the third quarter, if Jay Cutler doesn't throw that interception, we're in it. If he doesn't get stripped of that ball, we're going down to score and we're going to take the lead. Connor Barth missed a field goal, we would have been in a lead. We haven't even talked about that. But the point being that emotionally there was something wrong. And you could feel that the heart and soul was missing. And frankly, as a Bears fan, I agree with 630. That it may just be emotional in the way that I'll invest in the team if they invest in the team. If they invest in playing good football and they want to and they do something where it's a good product on the field, I'll tune in. But right now, I'm like, what are you doing? Like, I just feel like embarrassed. I feel embarrassed as a diehard Bears fan to watch that and be like, oh, man, my friends in all over the country are watching this team. You know how many texts I got last night? They were like, ha! They were just like a lot of emojis and things I didn't understand, being like, you're essentially saying you're the worst in the league. The worst in the league, man.
I know.
If it wasn't for RG3 and Josh McCown getting hurt in Cleveland, we would be the worst in the league. That is not, I mean, you hear that rhetoric because we're a negative town when it comes to sports and preseason. You hear it. But you're like, nah, there ain't no way. I've been saying it 10-6, 11-5. Right? This is worse off than where we were last year going into game 3 in Seattle, if you remember correct. I think that was a game 3 where Jimmy Clausen had the start because Jay Cutler got hurt, and we just looked like that was the worst football game in Bears history. I think they showed punt.
Yeah.
Like there was something like
eight punts in a row.
I don't think they got any first downs in that game. And here we come. We'll see what happens when Dallas comes to town. Are we in, or we're in Dallas?
Yeah.
Aye, aye, aye. Yeah. Real quick shoe update for me before we start. As I talked about yesterday, I got two new pairs of shoes. This is something that has been on the mind of Download Nation after I mentioned this summer that every single pair of shoes that I have has holes in the either sole or heel. And I realized my fall shoes included. Then when we did a little bit more investigating, we realized that I was buying $40 shoes, $50 shoes, trying to get them to last 2, 3, 4 years at a time. And we came to the conclusion together that I'm an idiot. And I'm not buying shoes correctly. So this weekend, I went to DSW, balling at the DSW. And I got two pairs of shoes, and I splurged. And I'll be honest with you, because I'm always honest with you guys, $200 is what I paid for two pairs of shoes. So $100 each. And yesterday I wore one of the pairs of shoes I was talking about. So comfortable. Great little pair of sort of casual professional, you know, sort of cool shoes. They were cool, right?
Yeah, very nice.
Cool. Like, and you told me I didn't get the. I need to like.
You gotta get the polish because they're a little leather.
Oil them up because they're leather. Mm-hmm. Real nice though. But as the night went on last night, I started to get this pain in my. I guess it's by my Achilles, essentially, like the back of my foot, whatever the heel, but the top part of the heel. And it was essentially a blister that when I got home last night and I took my socks off.
Is that all
it was
blood?
Huge. No, it was no blood. But it was just huge. And I was like, and it hurt. Like by the time I walked out of here, you know, and I walked out of the studio at midnight last night, I was like, I was like limping down Michigan Avenue like an idiot. So today I went home, I put some Neosporin on and I bandaged it up. I put a piece of cotton in there. I did a whole thing. I'm like, I'm going to prepare my foot for day two. I put the shoe on to leave and I was like yelping in pain. Like it just even through the cotton ball and it just landed right on the blister, the spot obviously. And I did maybe like I walked for like two steps. I'm like, So today I'm back in my canvas summer shoes that I've been complaining about with a huge hole in the back. I essentially had to duct tape my shoes today. But the good news is it doesn't touch any of the blister parts, so I'm okay. And when I told my wife about this, she just kind of looked at me and said, welcome to being a woman.
Mm-hmm.
Like, this is what we deal with all the time. And you know what? You're just going to have your foot heal before you can break the shoes in. So there you go.
But is it going to happen again?
That's what I said. I'm like, it's going to happen again. I'm not even sure how it's going to work. I need some advice because I feel like this is just not working for me.
I'm going to suggest as a former person in the shoe business.
Take them back?
No.
Okay.
I don't want anybody coming back. That was always the dread. You sell something and then like 2 weeks later you see the bag walking in. It's like, oh boy. Get a pair of insoles.
Mm-hmm.
And then
that'll lift it up.
It'll lift you up so it won't hit that spot.
Oh, that's interesting. That might be a good choice. That's a good idea. Maybe some gels. Am I gelling? Yeah, so I was super excited about the shoes. I still am. And I was thinking, I'm like, well, maybe I'll go get the other pair of shoes. Like I bought two and get those on. But then I got to the point where I was already downstairs by the door, you know, and I was just like, I got to go back because I, for whatever reason, have them up in the bedroom. And I was just like, yeah, it's a long way. These gray canvas shoes with a big hole in it, they'll be fine. I went into the utility closet, put a little duct tape in there. It's good. It worked for today. So
I don't want to ever hear you talk about the Bears' toughness any longer. I hear this story.
I've got a lot of heart and soul. Just, you know, you got to break in. He's a rookie quarterback, rookie shoes. You know, maybe I got him in there too soon. They need to be broken in, maybe in half hour increments. Not my strongest day, but that's okay. They'll be back.
Give him a workout.
Yeah, I will. I'm excited for him because I think it's going to be, you know, they're going to hit their prime time come November, December. That's when you're like, ooh, look at this guy. It's cold out. Look at those cool shoes.
Because I think with your shoes, and as far as women are concerned, I think what happens is like they're tight, you know. So your shoes aren't tight.
No, they feel like heaven. I'm not gonna lie to you.
I think it's a different thing.
Yeah. Well, I think what happens with women's shoes is that they never break in. So that's like the thing. That's what I've been told. So it's always that feeling. The hope with my shoe is that it'll break in and it'll be like, oh, this broke down. This leather's so comfy. It's so snug. Such snug shoe. I don't know. What do I know about shoes? But I'm excited to say that it looks so far like this shoe has held up today. And so maybe I'll just stick with this one and just keep those in the box. This is Chicago's very own 720 WGN Chicago and WGNradio.com. Some callers calling in right now, texting. Justin, put some duct tape on the blister. Duct tape's good for everything. 606, say, get some Keds high tops. Why didn't you buy some clogs, said 708. Go to Payless, said 630. Wear no-show socks, says 713. I don't know how that helps. And then my favorite is you got... talking about Lansing blisters, 773.
No.
Oh, that's come on.
Come on.
No, that's too much.
I don't know where that line is.
Where is the line? It's 10 o'clock at night. Yikes. No, Blister will be fine.
It's going down, y'all. Come worst, my people come first.
You know the deal. Worst come the worst, my people come first.
All right, it's 720 WGN. It's 10 o'clock on Tuesday night, and that means it's time for The Worst, our segment where we complain about the worst things in society for prizes. It's a simple concept. And we got good prizes. Pair of tickets to an unforgettable evening of music with the Broadway composer Stephen Schwartz. Wow. He's going to share stories of working on the Tony Award-winning musicals Pippin, Godspell, and Wicked. It's at the Mack Center at the College of DuPage, Friday, October 7th. That's a good price. So you could do that. We also got a pair of tickets to the Barty Bunch, which is a show at the Mercury Theater. And we've got a Lou Malnati's gift certificate. Lots to give away. 312-981-7200. You know the drill. What do you think's the worst? Call in, text, and get on the air. 312-981-7200. In studio with me tonight, Amy Guth. Amy Guth, of course, the longtime host here at WGN. She does the Saturday show, the Saturday Night Special. It's 7 o'clock, is that right?
That's the one.
Nailed it. And she also is still working on the documentary on online harassment, abuse, and civility. How's it going?
It's going great. You know, it's such an interesting topic because I'm the reason I made it a series instead of just one 90-minute doc is because it's a topic that keeps on giving.
Yeah, right.
Every time I look up, there's a new thing happening. And so every time I say, well, I've seen it all. No, nope, there's more. It's going to get weirder and worse. And so, I'm able to capture a lot of it and interview a lot of interesting people and share, you know, hear a lot of interesting stories.
Yeah, it feels like it's every single week we're hearing another story about bullying and,
yeah.
And I mean, Corey Feldman comes to mind. Is
right.
What we
He's
saw on the Today
latest.
Show. It's like, yeah. It's like he just, it's like almost watching a celebrity open the internet for the first time, seeing what pours out. Feel bad. Michael McCarthy, of course. How you doing, bud? Good to see you.
Good to see
He's
you.
Been on the program before. Michael McCarthy, a longtime Chicago. I guess we call you Chicagoan at this point. You've been living here for
a
long time. From Cleveland, but he's also a former writer for SNL, also a writer for Sesame Street, one of my. Not too many writers from Sesame Street come through the download store, so we appreciate that.
Oh, that's too bad.
And, of course, he is a teacher at IO right now. He teaches classes, and he's going to be a show called POV, which is on October 3rd. It's a talk show on stage at the IO, which is really, really part of the curriculum that you're teaching at IO.
Right. We try to, like, be as practical and make the abstract concrete, as I was saying before the show, but... it's basically going to promote a week's worth of programming at the IO, but it's really an excuse for my students to try out their jokes, which I think I have a very good group this session, so hopefully, fingers crossed, it'll be good. It'll be a success.
There
and
you
it won't
go.
End up as one of the worst.
Yeah, there. You know, it's the worst, that show.
That one show.
That one show at IO.
Yeah.
All right, 312-981-7200. The calls and texts are coming in. Let's start the worst. The way we start it every week is with Pete Zimmerman. Pete Zimmerman, how are you, my friend?
I am wonderful.
All right, you ready to start it off?
Yes. You know what's the worst?
What's the worst, Pete?
When you get a breaking news email,
mm-hmm.
and then it sends you to a paywall.
Oh, man. A breaking news email that sends you to a paywall. Not good. Yeah, that's not it. That's never good. I'm not a big fan of breaking news emails anymore.
Right.
Who does? I mean, there's so much that you can do beyond that. And I feel like I'm this close to having my Twitter feed, like, implanted into my head. Like, I don't need an email that tells me what's breaking.
Right. And people use breaking to label almost everything. Breaking, art gallery opening. Not really a breaking thing. Not
oh,
so
thanks.
Much. Like, save the breaking for the big stuff.
Yeah, right.
And I think we kind of overuse that a little bit. So that's a, I think we could reel it in just a bit on the breaking.
Breaking.
That's a good one.
I know. Developing. What happened to developing? I was a big fan
right.
of developing.
I
what
like developing.
Meaning,
like, we know the gist, but we don't know all the details.
Right.
Developing story. No need to panic yet.
No, exactly. 608 says the worst is the Bears. We'll just get that out of the way right
yeah.
now. So we don't have those all night. We got it. They were the worst that you. A lot of ways you can go there. All right, Amy, what do you got for the worst?
So recently I hurt my shoulder and I've been wearing a sling. I'm not wearing it tonight just because I'm stubborn in that way. But I was recently traveling a lot and people are like drawn to it like a moth to flame. They see someone wearing a sling, they'll like walk into it. And people kept like running into
me. Oh, no.
But more than one person said, oh, gosh, did I do that to you?
No, clearly you didn't do that to me. Clearly I showed...
Like the actual, like, sling?
Like gestured to it and was like, oh, did I just do that to you? Like,
yeah, no, you did. I grabbed the sling.
And
I had
you
a
made this,
come check this
sling
out.
Materialize just now on the moving sidewalk, which I thought was such a weird thing that people, their reaction to, like, oh crap, I just hit somebody who's injured.
That is it was very such a weird, strange.
And one of the people was like one of my seatmates. Like while
oh
I'm,
oh my god, did I just put your arm in a sling?
He's
I'm
like,
so
oh
sorry.
Gosh, did I just hurt you? And I'm like, no, no. He goes, did you have that? I mean, did you? I mean, you know what I mean? And I'm like, what are you saying right now, sir? What's happening?
It's kind of narcissism on a level that. Can't be- I'm completely in charge of everything I see and
everything I touch is affected, right?
You would need NASA instruments to be able to chart the narcissism. Regular calibration can take care of it.
All right, 312-981-7200. Michael, what do you got for the worst?
I hope they're not a sponsor of yours, but Spirit Airlines.
They're not a sponsor, but
oh, my God.
I don't know that they sponsor anything, do they?
Oh, no. Except pain and misery. I was just, you can breathe out for free, but inhaling costs $7 and also guaranteed to lose your luggage. It becomes sort of my, because I periodically teach these workshops in New York and I'll leave at 6 a.m. and
try to get and in
the
like an hour. Yeah.
The worst was to kind of grab the theme by the throat. I went to LaGuardia and I was flying back to Chicago, and the people working at the gate did a little play, a spontaneous sketch about how terrible the customers were, and I kind of lost it and went, we are the most beat up group of people in airports anyway. How dare you? Like, no, I'm normally.
Was it really? Was a Spirit Airlines like sketch?
Yeah. The ticket agent was going, one guy arrived late and he gave a bunch of excuses, and then they bowed, and it was one of those things where they were amusing each other.
Right.
And I just went, hang on.
I'd like to interject myself
Jesus.
Into the sketch.
Yeah.
I've got some sketch comedy background, if I could jump in right now.
I have
now.
Some notes. Can you sit down and just...
You know one of them had an MFA, and they were just exercising their right to use it there.
Or maybe they recognize you, Michael. They're like, he used to work on Sesame Street.
Do
so
a thing,
he'll
do
make
a thing.
Some calls. I can't wait to be able to make calls.
That's all right, that's what you're waiting on.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah.
312-981-7200. All right, so we'll take a break. I've got a lot of text coming here, and the lines are lit up, so we'll come back right after the break and get to everybody. Debbie, Allie, Jim, all the texts that are waiting. We'll get to you here on The Worst. Stay with us. It's The Worst here on 720 WGN, 312-981-7200. Amy Guth, Michael McCarthy in studio with me tonight as we get ready for the onslaught. And you guys have inspired people. There's a lot of transportation driven The Worst. So why don't we start right there? Why don't we start with Debbie? Debbie, what's The Worst, Debbie? You there, Debbie? No.
Hello?
Hi, Debbie. What's The Worst?
Hi.
Hi.
The worst is when you're a Uber driver and you pick up in Wrigleyville and have to drive 30 minutes and they poop in your car 3 times.
What?
And they'll tell you that they're annoyed with you because you're not home yet.
Okay.
Wow.
Does it work the same way as cabs where there's a thing on the Uber that says if you throw up in a car, you get $50? No?
No, it's in the app, and it's $150.
Oh.
Wow. Did that person get charged?
What was that?
Did that person get charged?
They did. I had to send pictures into Uber, and within 10 minutes, the money was in my account.
Oh, good. So, hey, that's not so bad. A little cleanup?
No, but it pretty much ends your night. You can't drive anymore because your car stinks. I mean, you're done.
Yeah, I guess you're right.
And that's kind of awful.
You have more money for the night.
Yeah, thanks, Debbie. That was good. Thanks.
That's kind of awful that you have to photograph it.
Oh, I know, right?
she's got that on her phone. These like
she's
barf
document
pictures.
It. Oh. It goes from there to Instagram.
I think that's in Dante's Inferno. Like one of the levels of hell
right,
is just right. Wrigleyville. Like
just across the way.
Pushing a boulder back and forth
right.
to Wrigleyville.
Right. All right. So let's keep going. Let's go to Jim. Jim, welcome to The Worst. What's The Worst, Jim?
I'll tell you what The Worst is.
Oh,
waiting in line at the self-checkout. Then you got to wait again for a price check on an item that doesn't scan, and you get no discount. All your groceries. What happened to the fast lane on this? It seems like there's more people in the self-checkout waiting in line than scanning through. And now they got video. I don't know what they're taking pictures. They got to charge us for
it. You're just really not digging the self-checkout, Jim. You seem to be very biased against the self-checkout.
No, it's just I don't know who's saving money, the company, not you.
Yeah, that's exactly what's happening, right? That's the end. Automated. That you think that's the beginning? Driverless cars, my friend. Go, Jim. he's gone. No, I do agree, essentially. My problem with self-checkout lines, I think I mentioned this a couple weeks ago at the worst, is that they've decided it's wild, wild west on how you line up for them. If you go to the grocery store now and you're not even sure, you're like, I think the line starts here, and you're down an aisle, and then people cut in front. I mean, it's just like, it's so, for the idea of going completely automated, they've almost made it even more wild.
How can we create more resentment? I think that's like the R&D, the brainstorming with dry erase boards. I know. No lines.
This will get them.
Yeah.
Well, there is kind of like, speaking of Wild Western transportation stuff, right, when we think about airports, like let's go back to the airport thing. As soon as they say, now boarding, people act like crazy people.
Yeah. Oh, I know.
And there's like shoving and weird entitlement. Like, we're all going to get on. It's fine. But weird entitlement stuff comes on. Like, even if you've got your elbow out, someone that's like, I'm zone one. And they'll, like, put their elbow in front of you just to, like, I'm just standing here. We're just here. It's good. It's a really weird thing.
It is a weird human society thing. Where when that bubble goes around the gate and all the people just are there and no one's really, everyone acts like they're just kind of, like, step by step sort of sneaking closer. Like, I'm not even, I'm just sneaking a little closer.
No,
I'm not doing anything. I'm just standing here. And you're like, what is happening that we all need to get as close as we can?
How can we make it more passive aggressive? Let's see. Anderson? Anderson in accounting? Do you have any ideas?
Right. All right, let's go to Allie. Allie, what's the worst, Allie?
Hello.
Hi.
Okay, so the worst is when you're having like a really fabulous, fantastic dream, you wake up from it, there's no way you can will yourself back into that great dream.
Yeah.
But if you're having a nightmare, you wake up, and no matter what you try, you always go back into that nightmare as soon as you fall back to sleep. Why?
So true.
Why?
Allie, that's a good
so
one.
True.
Yeah.
You just have to switch like Netflix. You have to like sign up for a new carrier that allows, you know, where there's a book and a hand opens it and you go to the table of contents.
I wish.
That would be, Allie, that is a good one. I agree. The great dreams never come back. The nightmares do, though, right?
Always do. Always do.
All right. Thanks, Allie. Thanks for that.
Thank you.
312-981-7200. We've got a lot of great texts as well I'm going to get to here. But
Do you guys, have you ever, like, maybe with writing that you've awakened in the middle of the night and had this amazing idea, and so you write down shoe tree, and you're convinced that you'll remember exactly what that is, and you wake up in the morning and, what the hell?
I have done that so many times, and usually it works out fine, but one of my weirdest is I woke up and I wrote Marxist Sharpay, and then went back to bed, and I have no idea. But at the time, I wrote it like with really like a heavy hand. Like I meant it, and I wrote Marxist Sharpay.
Great.
Why in the world?
Great sketch title. Great title for a sketch show.
Yeah, definitely.
Marxist
Sharpay. I agree. I think that I wonder how technology plays in that too, because I feel like half the time that I'm in any situation where I wake up and I'm like, oh, I need to write that down. I go to my phone to write it down in notes, and I get distracted by whatever's on the phone. Oh, I should check Facebook, too.
Yeah.
I should do this. And then you're like, well, what did it happen? Oh,
what
I
was
lost
it going to write?
It.
Oh,
yeah.
Yeah,
it's so good. 312-981-7200. 630 says the worst is being hungry and driving down a country road where there's nothing for miles. Wow. That's,
fair enough.
That is.
Route 61. I remember driving to L.A. from Chicago on Route 66. Forgive me. And no gas, nothing. Basically, a nuclear test site was basically for most of New Mexico. Yeah, I can weigh. That is the worst.
That is the worst.
We made it.
You would be surprised, though, with Route 66, you would think that they would, every mile, they would put a Hardee's, knowing that everybody's taking that route, right?
Yeah. Well, I think it was great in the, like, post-World War II, but now it's...
Yeah.
like a Sam Shepard play.
I completely forgot about Route 66, and I was at the Santa Monica Pier not too long ago, and I looked up and it said, this is where Route 66 ends or starts or whatever. I was like,
And it ends at, I think, Ogden and Wells.
Yeah, that's why I was like, I've been at both spots. There you go. Well, the worst is when you're an Uber driver and three blocks from your house and you pick up your last ride for the night and it's surging and they live 30 miles away. A lot of Uber drivers tonight.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So I guess surging is bad, but they live 30 miles away. I guess that's the point. They're three blocks from their house. Yeah. They want
to
go home.
You're about to turn it in for the night.
And you get a 30-miler.
And I wonder if that's what they say. Somebody away.
I wonder if Uber drivers are like have vernacular. If they're like, I got a 30-miler.
Right. Maybe.
like, yes, that's right.
Yeah, you're not going to believe what I got. I got a 30-miler. Ah, that's worst.
69 the cheesecake. Like if you're a waiter.
Right. Oh, man, we got someone who cheesecaked it. Yeah. They cheesecaked it. All right. 312-981-7200. I got a ton of texts. We're going to get to them. But first, let's get an update on tonight's news with Rob Martyr. So that's coming up. And then we will get to all your texts and phone calls. 312-981-7200. Amy Guth, Michael McCarthy in studio. Stay with us.
It's going down.
Thank you, Mr. Martyr. It's Justin Kaufman. It's 720 WGN, and it's the worst. That's right. We're playing the worst, where we complain about the worst things in society for prizes. Good prizes tonight. A pair of tickets to hang out with a Broadway composer. A pair of tickets to see the Barty Bunch. Also, a Lou Malnati's gift certificate. 312-981-7200. In studio with me, Michael McCarthy. He's a teacher at IO, as well as the show coming up he's going to be in called POV. Which will be on October 3rd. It's a talk show live on stage at IO. Michael will be the host. Also, longtime Second City alum, Saturday Night Live, Sesame Street. The list goes on and on and on, Michael. Always good to have you in studio, buddy.
It's great to be here.
Amy Guth, the host of Saturday Night Special. You can hear and the business lunch on Saturday. You do two shows. How do you do that? Do you stay at the radio station?
I do, yeah. I stay and I hang out in between shows.
Wow.
And I just I go huddle in the green room and just write or hang out or take a nap, whatever
right,
is happening.
Right.
But yeah, it's not really worth going home. I mean, it's a weird break because it's 5 hours between them.
Yeah,
so it's like not really worth going home, but it's not really. It's kind of too long to stay. So that's what I do. I hang out.
And that's good to know because I always hear there have been a couple times on Saturdays where I've heard you at 12 and I'm like, oh, there's Amy. And then I'll be like, turn the car on again later and then, hey, there's Amy. And I'm like, wait, has she been on the entire time? It's
I've possible. Only done that one time and it was during the blizzard.
Really?
I think Dean Richards was going to be on after me, and he couldn't get out of the airport or something. So I ended up sitting in the studio for 7.5 hours or something.
Wow.
At one point, I was like running out on the news breaks to the vending machine at the other end of the employee cafeteria, just like, what's left? I have like 12 cents. What do I have?
What do I have? Loot it. You should have just looted.
Shaking the vending machine for anything.
Amy's also working on her documentary on online harassment, abuse, and civility. That should be. And that has changed from a one-off sort of documentary to a series that you're working on.
Yeah. Because you know what, I really just couldn't stomach putting things like Facebook bullying and snark as the default language of the internet in the same breath as revenge porn and things like that, right? It just too much. And so I split it into a series, and it's the topic that keeps on giving. So I
look forward
roll
to it.
Along.
All right, so let's get to it. 312-981-7200. Let's get to the phones. Let's go to Maureen. Maureen, what's the worst, Maureen?
The worst is when you go to the eye doctor to have eye surgery,
okay.
And you get two shots in your eye to numb it,
okay.
And just before they start the surgery, they decide to have a fire drill, so you have to go out into the parking lot and wait a half hour while they do clear the building, and then you have to go back in and get two more shots because you're no longer numb, and you still get charged for them.
No!
Oh,
man.
Yes.
Oh, Maureen.
I like how the part of that story we're horrified by is that she got charged for it.
I know.
She got a shot in her eye.
So you got charged for four shots.
Oh.
Correct.
That's ridiculous.
Wow.
I know.
That's on them because that was a fire drill. It wasn't an actual fire, right?
I had to call and make a big stink, and eventually they did take the charges away. But when
good
the bill came, they had charged me for them. And I'm like, wait a minute. Right. I was standing in the parking lot couldn't see because my eyes were dilated too. And then you give me, I had to go back in and get two more shots.
But they removed the syringe, right? At least they
removed. Oh, yes. Yes, they did. Yes, they did.
All right, Maureen, that's a good one. All right, stay on the line for that one. I like that one. That's a good, that's a leading candidate worst.
I can just imagine her, you know, you can't walk out to the parking lot. You have to be led to the parking lot and just stand there.
And imagine if it was a real fire alarm and the doctor just were like, I'm out.
Yeah.
Like, I got to get out of this building. She'd be like wandering on the walls, the whole thing with her puffy eyes.
So much could go wrong there.
Wow, that's untimely. That's an untimely. Let's go to Richard. Richard, what's the worst, Richard?
Yes, before I get to that, the Route 66 Museum in Joliet, Illinois, a Stand the Bear signed by the Real Bears team, 1985 Super Bowl champs. But the worst is being in Wisconsin, being one of the few Bear fans, and still having Jay, I wish I could quarterback Cutler as a quarterback.
Yeah. Jay Cutler, yeah. The idea of Jay Cutler still a Bear, I agree. That's the worst. I appreciate it, Richard. Thanks for that. You're right. I told you there'd be a lot of it, man. There's a lot of there is a lot of anger and emotion around the simmering. Chicago Bears. It's simmering.
Sure.
847 says, you know what? Speaking of self-checkouts, did you know Juul did away with self-checkouts? I did not.
Yeah, CVS too, or at least the one in around our neighborhood.
Well, the CVS didn't really have to because they never actually worked. They always just had a flipped over cart or a basket sitting on them. Right, I don't think they ever worked at the one by me.
Yeah. Pardon our mess.
Right.
We're under construction. Like that, all of New York had that. The South Bronx had pardon our mess.
Yeah, right. 847 says the worst is working in a fast food restaurant. A guy comes in and takes his shoes off and takes money out of it to pay for the food.
Oh.
Come on now. That is... No, that's just not good.
Oh, that's just part of the intelligentsia.
Yeah, that's
just, yeah. I bet he has a story.
Let's get a real strong story.
Like Woody Guthrie.
Sit down. He's the man of the people, right?
Have a chin wag.
312, the worst is saving up for your first real vacation.
Oh.
Only to spend 3 of the 4 days alone with a stomach bug.
Oh. That's sad.
Yeah, sometimes they get sad. That's, Amy, that's the one thing you got to be ready. I don't think I prepped you guys.
Yeah.
It can get sad.
But at least there's nobody put a needle in your eye, huh?
Right.
Just, I think that's going to be for a week. That's what I'm going to talk to Susan and Sophia about.
All right, here we go. This is a good one. There's always sad, and then there's very technical.
Okay.
That's what happens with the worst. You have funny, sad, and technical.
I cannot wait.
630, the worst, working in the catering industry as a server. And everybody loves the bartenders and throws wads of cash at them. Meanwhile, the servers have to clean up all the glassware, keep the bar stocked, and people don't even acknowledge the server's existence, much less give them any tips. And just FYI, catering staff do not actually get the hourly rate the client is charged. And it continues.
Yeah, I feel you. I've been a cater waiter.
Me
I feel
too.
You. And you're right. They do give the bartenders all the love, which is why you just have to become a bartender really fast.
You got to work it out. 312 says, when your school is at full capacity and your alderman wants to merge it with another school so everyone can be confused and uncomfortable.
Well, not just your alderman, but your mayor.
Right. A lot of people with titles want that to happen. Well, that is a bummer though. If you're used to a school being a certain way, and they're like, let's merge, let's change that environment. We saw that obviously with all the school closings and things. But yeah, that is definitely the worst.
Heartbreaking.
All right, let's see. The worst is the guy who parks their big, shiny, showy muscle car diagonally across two parking spots in a crowded parking lot.
I find that my keys drop right on the hood usually.
Usually,
just completely. Sort of like Amy and her sling.
Yeah.
I'm so sorry that I spelled your parking like an idiot with my key, because I misspelled idiot. So because it was ironic.
It was ironic. I wanted 224 says the worst is people who sail through stop signs like the rules don't apply to them. Wow.
Can't argue with that.
At least nobody stuck needles in your eye.
Exactly. 815, the new credit debit card chip. It's not faster. I'm saying, man. 630, the worst is when your flight is delayed due to a belligerent passenger and you miss your brother's wedding that you were supposed to officiate.
Wow.
Oh, my Lord. That can't be true.
I was say, were you the belligerent passenger, sir?
That would be terrible.
That would be terrible.
But what happened? Like, when your flight's delayed due to, I mean, how belligerent does the passenger have to be to for the flight to be that late to your brother's wedding? Did you time the flight to show up like a half hour? Like, if everything goes perfect, I will be right at that. I'll be officiating that wedding right when I land. You know what I mean? Yeah. Like, there doesn't seem like there's a lot of wiggle room on either side of that.
And I feel like if you're the officiant, you probably need to get there the night before.
Yeah. Spring for the old hotel room.
Yeah.
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 Or if you're the officiant, I think they have to spring for it for you.
What is it in broadcast? Prior planning prevents poor performance, the 5 P's.
The 5 P's.
I think you could apply that to a wedding, too.
630, this is a good one. This is one of my faves. This might make the actual top three here. Social media during the election season. Even the cat videos have an agenda. That's a good one.
That's pretty good.
That's a good one. All right. Let's go to Patrick. Patrick, what's the worst, Patrick?
Hey, the worst is when you're working in an attic and you have to get into the attic using a 10-foot ladder, and you go to get out of the attic, and one of the people you've worked with moved said ladder.
Ooh.
And you're so hot that you didn't even care to look. You thought, of course, the ladder's here. Why wouldn't the ladder be there?
Oh, no.
And you dropped 10 feet onto the floor.
Are you okay? Like, did you break anything?
Yeah, I didn't break anything, but, you know.
Yeah.
Nobody realizes how attics get really, really, really hot. Like, on any given day, but if it's sunny out, your attic's usually like 120 degrees.
Yeah.
So we have a rule in the summer, you know, you only work 20 minutes in the attic, then you come down for 10.
Yeah.
So on. But when you're working on something, you know it's only going to take a couple more minutes. You don't worry, you know. Now I always think about that 20-minute rule. Yeah, and I was a little lightheaded, came out. Like I said, let's put my foot on the ladder with all my weight. And just went, right out the hatch.
All right, thanks, Patrick. Thanks for that. That's
gives me new insight in terms of Anne Frank.
Doesn't he? There you go, right.
Yeah.
Strong. Any attic, Anne Frank. 901, the worst sticky buns. That's all it is.
That's the pastry, right?
I think so. I hope so. You know what's the worst? Air mattresses. It feels like sleeping on a damn pool toy. The worst? Male pattern baldness on your aunt. What is that? All right, 312-981-7200. We'll take a quick break. We'll come back, and we'll reward the winners tonight. There's a lot of worse going on here on A Download. Stay with us.
It's going down,
773 says the worst is when you go to the casino with your sister, and every time you win a little money, she's got her hand out asking for some.
Yeah. I told my brother not to text.
214 says the worst and when you text the worst with the best kick ass worst and all you get is crickets.
That's nice. That one's kind of meta. I like
815. This must be from a police officer. 815 says the worst is patting down an arrest and squeezing his colostomy bag.
I hope.
Oh, man.
I hope it's a cop.
And 708 says, getting a shot in the roof of your mouth. Not the gum, but the roof. Mm. Oh.
We can hook that one up with Maureen. They can talk about shots.
You guys can make it all happen.
Yeah.
Wow. 312-981-7200. Amy Guth and Michael McCarthy in studio. Let me give their titles and everything here. Amy, of course, can hear on WGN Radio Saturday. She does the business lunch. It's 12, and then she's back on at 7. With Saturday Night Special. Michael McCarthy, also doing the online harassment documentary, which is going to be a series coming out soon. Michael McCarthy teaches at I.O., is a former Second City main stage guy, also Saturday Night Live writer, as well as Sesame Street writer. I love that credit. and he is a teacher at I.O., and he's going to be in the show POV October 3rd at I.O. It's a talk show. Michael will be hosting it. All right. So let me read what we've got for the top three prizes. I have to do this for work here. For third place, you're going to get a Lou Malnati's gift certificate. Lou Malnati's is home of Chicago's best deep dish pizza. Find one of their 40-plus Chicagoland locations or order online at loumalnatis.com. Second place is going to get you a pair of tickets to the Barty Bunch playing at the Mercury Theater Chicago from September 15th to November 20th. Come on, get happy at this musical parody mashup of a dozen Shakespeare plays set in the 70s and featuring the warring sitcom families Brady and Partridge. Get tickets at mercurytheaterchicago.com or call 773-325-1700. I heard Anna Belleval was all over that this morning. I was watching. She was at that. She performed in it.
Wow.
Yeah, they had a little thing on GN Morning News.
I'd love to see it. Yeah. That sounds awesome.
Yeah, right? It's like a nice little mashup. And first place tonight is going to get you a pair of tickets to an unforgettable evening of music with the Broadway composer Stephen Schwartz as he shares live performances and behind-the-scenes stories from Tony Award-winning musicals Pippin, Godspell, and Wicked. It's at the Mackinac Center in DuPage on Friday, October 7th. Call 630-942-4000 for tickets. That's at the College of DuPage, the Mac at the College of DuPage. All right, so that's the third, second, and first. All right. 262 just brought one in that I think is great, although it won't make it to the top three. The worst is spending the whole evening at the emergency room, but nobody helps you, so you got to call 911. Oh, no. Right? Terrible. 309 says the worst is accepting a job 2 months ago and just finding out that the business is on the auction site.
Oh.
So what does that mean?
Sign of the times.
Means it's a going out of business?
Zeitgeist.
There you go. All right. All right. So let's do this. Okay. So third place tonight is going to go to a texter. This was 630. I'm getting down. I'm going to find it here. Da, da, da. Yeah. 630 says... What do you know what's the worst? Social media during the election season, even the cat videos have an agenda. That's third place. They're going to get a pizza, Lou Malnati gift card. Congratulations on that. All right, second place. Are we ready for second place?
Sure.
Second place is going to be for caller Allie. Allie, who says that the worst is waking up from a great dream and not being able to go to it, unless it's a nightmare, which you get sucked right back into. And it's true. And then it's something we have to figure out as a society, as a whole. I don't know how we do it.
I remember reading recently that Rod Serling would eat very spicy food, set his alarm clock, and wake up at 3 in the morning and write down his nightmares, and those became Twilight Zones.
Wow.
Is that really true?
Yeah, apparently.
That's worth trying. I'm
so
just
spicy
saying.
Food is like the lead into nightmares?
Maybe whatever the opposite might get you back to your rom-com.
If you eat
vanilla,
like malto meal,
just your bland food.
You're writing episodes of Friends when you wake up.
A crusty yet benign police detective is befriended by a young upstart. I'm so there.
That's good. All right, so first place. Are we ready for Maureen? Maureen, are you on the line?
Yes. Thank you very much,
Maureen. You got first place for the terrible story. The worst. When going to the eye doctor, getting two shots in your eyes, and then having an impromptu fire drill where you have to go to the parking lot and then return and get two more shots, which they charged you for. It's a
Thank
ridiculous
you very
story.
Much.
So you're going to be able to go. So at least this makes up for some of that, let's just call it out, it was pretty tragic, your situation.
Well,
are you traumatized by it?
No, not at all. I'm from a big family. There's not much that can traumatize me. So,
I've had needles in my eyes many a time.
So thank you very much.
All right. Thanks, Maureen. Stay on the line there. All right. So Maureen wins.
She's How big a family?
Yeah, right.
I love that. That's
the answer.
I'm from a big
family.
You
know what? I'm fine. Not even worry about it.
Listen, I don't need to.
Needles in the eyes, no big deal.
I can sleep.
It's a thing.
Michael McCarthy, Amy Guth, great to see you guys. Thanks for coming in studio and playing the worst tonight.
Always a pleasure.
Yeah.
All right, another successful worst here on the download.